Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and light me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient.
Alright, alright, alright. Hi. How are you doing? We are live in the Skyline studio here. It's Nick DiGilio and my producer is Tom Hush, and we're here till 4. As we are every weekday morning. This is Sunday into Monday morning. And because it'll be Monday morning, my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. My dad calls in every Monday morning and starts off your work week with a joke, and he'll do that again later on this morning. We have a Blackhawks Express that we'll play back, and also a big night for Patrick Kane. Fourth player on the Blackhawks to reach 1,000 points. And what an unbelievable season he's having, and what a joy it's been to watch Patrick Kane play on our team. So it couldn't have happened at a better time. It, you know, he did it at home. His parents were in the crowd at the UC, and so we got some moments there with Patrick Kane that we're going to talk about a little bit later on too. So we were talking about possibly should the Super Bowl be moved to a Saturday. That's a little. That's a story that's out there right now. People talking about that. Boy, that would be a big switch. We also have like some real demands that were made by celebrities behind the scenes. We have TV's most controversial characters. Hank Azaria, by the way, is no longer going to voice Apu on The Simpsons. Speaking of controversial characters, and we've got that coming up as well. And of course, we've got the guys are coming in, Eric and Steve, and we're going to review the new movies. This week we also have the SAG Awards were handed out this evening, and we'll talk about that. And also, if you have any sports memorabilia, cards or anything, Michael Osaki is going to be here. He is with Baseball in the Attic, and you can call in, and we'll get you guys out, get you to find out how much some of your stuff is worth. If you've got some stuff laying around in the attic, or if you got some stuff in a closet somewhere, sports memorabilia. Michael Osaki will be happy to appraise it for you. You can call in at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That's the phone number. It's also talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show, and subscribe to our podcasts. Every second of every show is podcast, and you can go to WGNRadio.com, check out the podcast, go to iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe. It's free, and it will automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there it is. Welcome, and we hope you want to join us at 312-981-7200, and let me say hello to officially to my producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick. How are you doing, man?
I'm okay. I'm all right. Excited for Patrick Kane. It was a lovely moment.
Yeah, big moment. You know, it's always good to see a guy that has been so important for this city, this team.
Yeah.
Just accomplished that milestone, and he was really humble about it too. He was really just about like, yeah, this is what I do. This is my game.
You know, what's so much fun to watch over the years is just how we seriously watched him mature. Like, you know, it just right before our eyes. You know, he's an incredibly gifted hockey player. But also a really good guy, and to watch him mature over the years, because he was young when he started with the
he
acted young, you know.
Yeah.
but it's amazing to see how mature, not just as a player he's gotten, but as a person. It's the development of this guy is just it's amazing. We're lucky to have him on the team. So anyway, congratulations to Patrick Kane on his 1,000th point, and we'll talk more about that a little bit later on. So did you watch any of the SAG Awards?
I caught a little bit of it.
Yeah.
I caught a little bit of it, and I was following along a little bit later when I got on my bus.
Yeah.
And I was looking at all the winners. Some pretty big surprises. Some things that I expected. Some things that I was like, yeah, Brad Pitt's going to win. You know, he's going to get supporting.
Yeah.
And but the big one of the night, the Best Ensemble Cast, I believe, is the award. Yeah. Parasite.
Parasite.
Which is a really big one. I believe that's
the first foreign language film to win the SAG Cast Award.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, this movie is pretty much, it's taken a lot of people by storm, this Parasite movie. So anyway, by the way, it's Nick DiGilio here. We are live and here until 4 a.m. And we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. And every week we talk about the movies and we're going to review them with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, and we're going to continue with that, and the guys are going to be joining me to talk movies. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline Studio, and you are listening to the Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is my producer. We're here till 4. Roger Badish is in the newsroom, and that's who's going to be keeping you company until 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. Lots of other fun topics that we're going to get to. But that music obviously means that it is time for the movie reviews. We do it every week. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me. We talk about all the new movies and touch on the box office as well. So let's get the guys in here. Here's Eric. Welcome back. Are you there, Eric? Eric? Hold on. Eric? I don't hear Eric. Eric?
Hello?
Yeah. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, and Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
All right, good. Everybody's here. We got that all cleared up. Okay. So we've got some movies to talk about. Did you guys watch the SAG Awards? Eric, did you watch?
I did not watch the SAG.
Mm.
I watched a little bit of them. I mean, there were no surprises in the movie categories, really.
No.
That's why I didn't watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're pretty much going to have to come to terms with the fact that Joaquin Phoenix is going to win an Oscar for it.
Movie.
Yeah. So, and it looks like Renee Zellweger is going to get it. I mean, I think everything is set in stone. I thought the funniest speech of the night was Brad Pitt. I thought Brad Pitt was
oh, sure.
It was
he was very good.
He was hilarious. And there's like really some really kind of lovely footage of him backstage standing in front of a big screen TV watching Jennifer Aniston accept her award.
There was a nice moment where he talked about playing a guy who didn't get along with his wife, and they did a nice cut to her in the audience, kind of laughing at it. And and I thought that's good direction. That's good television direction.
Yeah.
So,
not a lot of surprises, you know. And I think we all know, you know, what direction we're going to with the Academy Awards.
I don't know what's going to win Best Picture though. I'm totally confused.
Okay,
and director for that matter.
That's well, yeah. I mean, I think it's going to split again. I really do think it's going to split again.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. It's Nick DiGilio here, and we are with Eric and Steve, who join us every week to talk about the movies. That's what we're doing right now. Tom Hush is producing, and it's the Nick DiGilio Show right here on 720 WGN. Okay, Steve, why don't you tell us about the Les Miserables?
Yes. So this is the, speaking of Academy Awards, this just got nominated for Best International Feature, which used to be Best Foreign Language Feature, but it was also the winner of the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival last year. It obviously shares the name of the classic novel by Victor Hugo, but it is not that story or the musical that was based on it. Although it does have a lot of the same themes as that book, themes about haves and have-nots and challenging corrupt authority and oppression of poverty. But it's mainly named that because the Paris neighborhood where it takes place, and I believe it's called Montfermeil, is where Victor Hugo wrote the novel and took inspiration from a lot of the surroundings that he saw, even back then. This is a debut feature from a French filmmaker named Lodge Lee, and it's basically driven by sort of the tense race relations and culture clashes and general sense of frustration with underemployment that is happening in this part of Paris. It's a real fascinating dissection of power, focusing a great deal on these children of Muslim immigrants from various backgrounds who spend a lot of summer days playing soccer and just sort of doing unremarkable sort of mischievous things. And then there are these Paris police officers. There's one named Stefan who has recently been transferred into this anti-crime squad in the community, and he's paired with these two other guys who are veterans, and they have pretty unorthodox methods, and they're a little rough around the edges, but they, you know, everybody, all the different neighborhood groups know them. So the trio kind of find themselves overrun during the course of an arrest, and a drone owned by one of the local teams films something that they definitely do not want filmed, and a lot of the film is then the cops chasing down this drone footage, and they have to kind of work their way through the community and make the best use they can of their sort of allegiances and the connections they have in the neighborhood to make this happen. And apparently this is partially inspired by some riots that took place in the suburbs of Paris around 2005, and that lasted for weeks. And so there is a great deal of, like, volatile situations cropping up very quickly and just getting diffused almost as quickly. There are these magnificent characters to get to, in addition to the police, there are these different guys in the community, these leaders or the sort of crime leaders, but when the police actually try to arrest this one kid, like I said, this drone footage sort of captures what happens, and it's really bad news. And like I will say, the director does an exceptional job of immersing us in the neighborhood, from the bustling local markets to these claustrophobic stairwells and broken down parks. There's a final sort of sequence and shot that leaves a significant amount of the narrative thread completely up for interpretation, and that may seem like a bit of a cop-out, but really this is a film that never attempts to hand us easy answers about how to fix these things, because there really are none, and that's a powerful and, I think, pretty defiant statement. It's a film that challenges audiences to consider situations from every possible point of view, and though some may not like the ending, the trajectory of everyone involved in the various conflicts was intriguing enough to keep me along for the ride, certainly. So I'd say it's mostly positive for me. I know it's playing at the Music Box, and I think also River East.
Yeah, it is. All right. Well, there's that. And it's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking movie reviews with Eric and Steve. Tom Hush is the producer, and we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Okay, Eric, tell us about Jezebel.
Okay, this is a movie that is playing at the Facets this week. Played a few film festivals last year, including South by Southwest and our own Black Harvest Film Festival. And it's a story, it's kind of a semi-autobiographical story that's set in the sort of the early 1990s. The director of the film is a woman named Numa Perrier, and she plays a woman who works as a phone sex operator, and she lives in kind of a tight, cramped Las Vegas motel with a number of her family members, including her younger sister and their very ill mother. When the mother eventually passes away, very early in the film, the young younger sister, Tiffany, is played by Tiffany Tennille, just doesn't know exactly what her what direction her life is going to go in. And her sister recommends that there's this new thing that is basically cam girls. And she actually recommends, going to this local business and trying out as a cam girl. This is very much in the sort of the infancy of this, the internet was growing in the early 1990s. So she goes to this, seedy, but, not too seedy location, and becomes a cam girl and starts learning the ropes, with other women there. And, they kind of form, a bit of community, to each other. And as she goes along, she becomes more comfortable in her skin and begins developing sort of greater relationships with the men that are frequenting this particular business. And so she's sort of a greater sense of empowerment, and not to mention the money that she's bringing in. We've seen there have been a number of movies about this particular profession before. A lot of them, tend to sort of err on the seedier side, and this movie certainly doesn't shy away from that. But this one is definitely less seedier than some of the other ones, mainly because the characters have really strong relationships, particularly between the two sisters. It's one of the things that helps, I think, set this movie apart from a lot of these other ones. There's also the fact that the protagonist is African American. There is elements of racism that get brought into this world, and so the way the film deals with that, I think, is something that we haven't quite seen, portrayed in some of these other types of movies. The film kind of ends on kind of a abrupt note that kind of leaves a lot of threads kind of hanging about. I think that this is this weird world that these women occupy is always pretty fascinating. And I think this one is a bit better than a lot of the ones that we've seen, or at least I've seen at some of these film festivals. And again, it's particularly because I think the relationships and the lead actresses are quite strong in it. So it's definitely one to take a look at Facets.
Okay, that's called Jezebel, and it's playing at Facets. It's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline Studio, the Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is producing. Eric and Steve are here. They join me every week to talk about the movies, and Jezebel was the movie we were just talking about at Facets. By the way, I was just looking up the IMDb page for this, and by the way, they completely restructured IMDb.
I noticed that.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely. Yeah, I mean, I was like, what? I didn't even know I was on the same website, but they completely changed it. So you got to navigate it a little closely. But anyway, I was looking at this, and the lead actress is from Chicago. Tiffany Tennille?
Yeah,
she's from Chicago.
Okay.
So, there you go. Okay. All right. We are going to continue with Eric and Steve and the movie reviews. 312-981-7200 is our number for any for talk and text, and the movie reviews continue. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's the Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is producing. We're here until 4. Roger Badish has your news, and that's who's keeping you company into the late night, early morning. My father is going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and every Monday my dad calls in and tells a joke, so we'll continue with that. We are going to be talking about real demands made by celebrities behind the scenes. Hank Azaria is no longer going to voice Apu on The Simpsons, and then we're going to talk more about most controversial TV characters. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. As we continue, it's Nick DiGiulio and Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning / Sunday night, Monday morning, to review the new movies. And that's what we're doing. And we continue. Okay, Eric.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us, I'm sorry, Steve, tell us about Doolittle.
Damn it. Okay. So the new year is young, but thank goodness we didn't have to wait more than a couple weeks to hit our first sort of big budget military grade stink bomb of 2020.
I have to say, before you jump into this, I cannot believe who wrote and directed this movie.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's my next sentence.
I can't
literally.
Even, yeah. Okay.
So the director and co-writer is a man named Steve Gagan, who won an Oscar a few years ago for writing Traffic. He also directed a couple films before this, Syriana and Gold. So, of course, he seems uniquely qualified to rework the character of Dr. John Doolittle, who was the central figure of a series of children's books by Hugh Lofting, going back to the 1920s, and his adventures in communicating with animals and a few humans, too, have been adapted to the big screen a few times already, most famously Rex Harrison in the 67 musical Dr. Doolittle, and then a pair of Dr. Doolittle films starring Eddie Murphy. But this latest incarnation stars Robert Downey Jr. as the famed 19th century physician whose wife passed away 7 years earlier than when we meet him. And ever since then, he's confined himself to a life of solitude behind the walls of his country estate, where he lives and communicates with a variety of common and exotic animals, very often in their languages, although thankfully we hear most everything in English eventually. A young Queen Victoria, who's played by Jessie Buckley, falls gravely ill, and her, I guess, young ward, Lady Rose, is dispatched to pull Doolittle out of hiding and then to cure Her Majesty. So Rose arrives at his house about the same time as a local boy does named Tommy, and he's seeking the doctor's help as well because he shot a squirrel who's voiced by Craig Robinson, who he accidentally shot while being forced to go hunting by his family. Anyway, so while he isn't moaning and screeching with the animals, the first thing you sort of notice about Robert Downey Jr.'s performance is this weird choice of accent, which sounds vaguely Scottish. And I think the person that Dr. Doolittle was sort of based on was Scottish, but I'd never heard anyone try this accent before. He when we first meet him, he's kind of like long-bearded wild man, hiding from all outside visitors, but eventually he does sort of shave himself and saves the squirrel's life and agrees to help out the queen as well. And he takes this young kid, Tommy, as his sort of provisional apprentice. The sights and sounds of Dr. Doolittle conversing with animals, ranging from sort of a dog wearing glasses, who's voiced by Tom Holland, to a gorilla with PTSD, who's voiced by Rami Malek. There's a polar bear that John Cena voices, arguing with an ostrich, Kumail Nanjiani does. I guess they're all supposed to bring us the sense of wonder and amazement. Instead, the film is just a colossal bummer. Doolittle, he is in a deep depression for most of the film because his wife has died, but he's also so in love with how weird the movie's also sort of in love with how weird it thinks it's being and how edgy it is, and it kind of takes the wind out of every possible aspect of this movie that might be fantastical. The two younger actors spend most of the time on screen just sort of staring at things with wonder and big eyes, but basically the big eyes only really show us how empty their souls are, because they're just so, when people talk about stereotypical child actors, they're talking about these two, and maybe they could be better with different material, who knows. Anyway, Doolittle, along with his animals, sort of set out on this adventure to acquire some medicinal ingredients from a rare tree that's needed to save the queen. There's something of a conspiracy going on that involves some of the queen's close advisors, including one played by Jim Broadbent, as well as her personal physician, who's played by Michael Sheen. They get to this island where the tree is supposed to be. There's like a pirate king played by Antonio Banderas, reminding us why he's never been Oscar nominated before this week. And there's a tiger in it that's voiced by Ralph Fiennes, and a dragon, and I don't know. There's no shortage of voice and acting talent in the movie. And when you add to that, the cinematographer is Guillermo Navarro, who is Guillermo del Toro's regular cinematographer, but he's also lensed two of the three Night at the Museum's films, which actually, when you watch this, makes a lot of sense. And there's a Danny Elfman score. I mean, like, there's a makings of a damn fine film here, or so you'd think. But instead, we get, like, this cluttered, noisy, dark thing with not much of an adventure to speak of. I was watching Robert Downey intently at times, just looking for any clue what John Doolittle might be thinking, other than sort of this generic sadness. Honest to God, the Craig Robinson squirrel emotes more than Robert Downey Jr. does in this movie. And there's a couple funny line deliveries by some of the voice actors, and that's largely what makes the film even in any way watchable. The animal effects are really unimpressive. The action sequences are sparse and in desperate need of some inspiration. And by the end, I was bored, I was miffed, I was exhausted. By watching so many good people work so hard to achieve mediocrity. So that's Dr. Doolittle, guys.
Okay. All right.
Doolittle.
Yeah. Nick DiGilio here, and it's Steve and Eric and Tom Hush is producing. We're here until 4, and we're doing the Sunday night / Monday morning reviews as we do every week. And again, it's the Nick DiGilio Show. All right, Eric, where do you stand on Doolittle?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes movies come along, and this movie's been kind of sitting on a shelf for a while, and no one knew when it was going to come out, and there have been reshoots and problems with the production. And I think, you know, that sometimes kind of supersedes whatever quality or failure that the movie's ultimately going to kind of rest on. And, you know, I'm not saying that that's not important, because I think that, it is right sometimes to be angry that $175 million was spent on a production like this, and this is the end result. But at the same time, there's almost like a weird level of extra outrage, I think, sometimes for a movie that is just boring. After 90 minutes, which is really all this movie really is, I wasn't exactly exhausted. I was just kind of sat there slumped in my seat, trying to think that it would this movie really appeal to children. Yes, it's got all these talking animals and some great voice talent behind them, not that they would know who any of them are, but I kept thinking the entire movie, going back to the Eddie Murphy Doolittle movies, which is kind of, this movie kind of wants to, like, split the difference between being the kind of fantastical adventure type of story that, going back to the Rex Harrison film, but then inserting the humor and, the modern humor of the Eddie Murphy movies into this, and it's just, it doesn't make for a fine mix, because for one, the animals in this movie are not nearly as entertaining as they were in the Eddie Murphy movies, and the adventure is so CGI'd to the point of, I guess that's where any kind of exhaustion lies on my part, is that nothing feels genuine. Nothing feels, you don't really get a sense of place and the getting swept up along in this adventure, because you just see everything is just kind of fake, polished and fake and just not that interesting. Not even, weird performance from Robert Downey Jr. can save this. Craig Robinson's squirrel, his first line in the movie made me laugh quite a bit. But beyond that, I just kind of was sitting there waiting to see if, this movie really going to be the disaster that people were setting me up for the kill for. And I think that the humor is not all that different from some of the more mediocre children's fare, both animated and live action, that we've seen, and that's really all I got out of it. So, yeah, it's not very good, but I'm not going to waste a whole lot of outrage on it either.
Okay. And you said that this was sitting on the shelf for a while?
It's been sitting around. It's shifted release dates a few times. There have been reshoots on it. A new director was brought in to film some stuff, because Gagin was apparently a nightmare on set. And he was not a particularly good director before, I might point out. I'm not even a fan of Siriana. But yeah, I mean, you release a $175 million production in the middle of January. That's not a good sign.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's Doolittle. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show on a Monday morning, Sunday night, Monday morning. And we've got Eric Childress and Steve Procopi here to review the new movies, which we do every week, and that's what we're doing right now. So Doolittle is not worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Wait, Nick, you didn't see it?
No, I did not.
No, okay.
I did not. No, uh-uh. Yeah, you know, I saw...
It's cold out there, Steve. It's cold.
Yeah, it was cold out
there. Not that cold.
Yeah. I saw the I saw the Eddie Murphy Doolittles, and that was fine. That was pretty much enough for me. So, yeah. But I did see the other big movie that came out this week, and we're going to review that coming up. And and 312, and the movie is Bad Boys for Life. It's the latest in the Bad Boys, well, now trilogy.
Yes.
With Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. So that's coming up. We continue with the Nick DiGilio Show here on 720 WGN. Tom Hush is producing. I'm Nick DiGilio. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me at this time every week to review the new movies on the Nick DiGilio Show here on 720 WGN. And, all right, Eric.
Yes.
Tell us about Bad Boys for Life.
Okay. Well, as you said before the break, this is the third part in what is now a trilogy of the series that began 25 years ago, we can age all of us. 25 years ago, we met Marcus Burnett and Mike Lowry, Martin Lawrence, Will Smith. And so now it is 2020, and as the movie opens, we are welcoming the birth of Marcus's grandchild. His daughter has given birth and is also on the verge of getting married. And he's thinking about retirement, Murtaugh style. And so Will Smith's Mike Lowry's character is not exactly ready to go off into the sunset, but when he becomes the target of a widow of a drug cartel kingpin who was taken out many years ago, Mike is on a list for assassination, and it seems like the bad boys are going to ride together one more time to stop the level of these assassinations from happening, including Mike's. So we get another series of chase sequences and shootouts and trying to get to the bottom of who is behind this scheme and whatnot. Joe Pantoliano is back as their captain. They actually kind of have a whole new crew around them as Marcus wants to be a bit more careful and have a bit more backup, a la Billy Crystal and Running Scared. This is exactly what you might expect from the Bad Boys series. But going back to the last time we met, or we hung out with these two, which was 17 years ago, we were given Bad Boys 2, which I don't know if we're complete unanimous here, but I still consider Bad Boys 2 to be one of the most revolting, vile experiences I've ever had in a movie theater.
I agree with you 100%.
Steve, are you with us on that?
I like Michael Shannon in it.
See, I completely forgot Michael Shannon. I blocked that movie out like nobody's business. That movie literally made me physically ill in the theater when I saw it. And I don't get motion sickness, but for other reasons, that movie made me ill. So needless to say, I was not looking forward to this movie. But this movie is not directed by Michael Bay. It's directed by a pair of new directors. Directors who have been doing features, but I'm actually not familiar with any of them. The names are Adil El Arbe and Bilal Fallah. And I thought I had seen one of their movies. I looked it up, and it turns out it was not the title of the movie that I thought I had seen. But they replaced Michael Bay. While you know, a lot of the shootouts and the things that you might come to expect in the series do play out in a way, these directors have a few steps ahead of Michael Bay as far as terms of crafting the action sequences. I'm not saying that we're on the level of Mad Max Fury Road or anything like that here, but there's at least a coherence to some of them. There's occasionally a bit of creativity, there's a little bit of space, and I found myself at least semi-engaged watching the action sequences in this movie. I still don't really like these two characters. I never really have. They were certainly burdened in the first two movies by the comedy stylings of Michael Bay, and that certainly didn't help matters very much. And they're kind of at the same level of humor in this one, and every once in a while I got a chuckle out of me, but not so much. Plus, they were participants in Bad Boys 2, so I haven't quite forgiven them for that either. But like I said, this movie was surprisingly watchable. I didn't want the level of complaints that I would have had with Bad Boys 2 are not really did not really manifest themselves while I was watching this movie. So this all sounds like really faint praise here, but compared to the other two movies, and I'm not really recommending this entirely, but of the three movies, I would actually say that this is the best one of the three, just because I didn't feel like Michael Bay's style was sort of overwhelming the proceedings and trying to show us just how cool everything was. Maybe the fact that these characters, that we've all sort of aged with these characters and they're sort of playing upon the fact that they're growing older and stuff like that, maybe that worked a little bit better for me. But at the same time, watching them sort of even steal, as I was alluding to, from Lethal Weapon and Running Scared and elements of those movies to use for their, you know, sort of new renaissance of these characters didn't really, you know, sit great with me either. So I'm not recommending the film, but I'm saying it's better than the two Michael Bay movies.
Okay. It is Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show, reviewing the new movies. Tom Hush is your producer. I'm Nick DiGilio. Eric and Steve are here. Steve, what about you?
I think I have the exact same review as Eric, but I am recommending it just barely. You know, and we should mention that for better or worse, Michael Bay doesn't come back as a director, but that doesn't mean he's not involved in this movie somehow. Tell me, I don't think this is spoiling anything, but there was a moment, a fleeting moment near the beginning of the film where I thought this movie was going to be so gutsy. Because I thought they killed off a major character. I thought they were thinking about killing off a major character at the beginning of this movie. And I'm like, oh my God, that would make this movie so gutsy and so bold. And I'm like, I hadn't even considered they might do that, because if this is really supposed to be the last one of these, although they certainly set it up like it's not, but just a brief moment, I was like, oh, but of course, no, they don't kill it. They kill people, but they don't kill that person. So anyway, Eric's 100% right, though. When this film focuses on the action, oh my God, it's really great. And I will say, these two guys who mostly, I think, have made most of their films have been made in the Middle East, that they have a real flair for it, and there's like the chasing and the shooting and the general mayhem are at least a little bit more original than they're not the same as Michael Bay has given us in the past. I will say that the part of this that really let me down was because this is like an action comedy series, and it's the comedy that's a real drag on this movie, and it kind of keeps it from being like a really righteous action romp. And I did like the inclusion of these newer characters, these younger, sort of more with it characters in this team that they work with, and Vanessa Hudgens is one of them. But I kind of like that interaction and just that comparison of the older generation versus the younger generation, how they kind of make it work. There's a couple strange little story twists in this that one which I think is sort of genuinely shocking, the other is kind of genuinely laughable. I was also really impressed with the villainess who is, I guess, supposed to be a witch, played by Kate Del Castillo, who it took me a while to realize where I knew her from. I had seen her in this film last year called El Chicano, but do you guys know what she's famous, famous for?
Steve, we're running out of time.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, she was friends with El Chapo. Anyway, so my point is that, like I said, the Bad Boys for Life isn't an embarrassment, I guess. That's not saying much, but, you know, for those who hold it dear, this franchise dear, I'm sure they'll like it.
Okay. All right. I'm with you guys entirely. I think it's actually a pretty well-made movie, and it's definitely better than the other two.
Yeah.
So, all right, guys. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yep.
All right, Eric and Steve, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on 720 WGN. It's Nick DiGilio here. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's the Nick DiGilio Show on this late Sunday or early Monday morning. Tom Hush is the producer. Hi, Tom. Hey. And we continue. And coming up, Michael Osaki is going to join us. He's from Baseball in the Attic, and he will appraise any of the sports memorabilia that you have. If you got stuff laying around in the closet somewhere or in the attic, take it out, describe it to us, and he will appraise it. He's a professional appraiser, and we get him on every once in a while to talk about your memorabilia. And if you would like to join us, we would love to have you at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. A couple of texts came in as we were talking about the movies. 312 says, I still can't forget the rats having sex in Bad Boys 2. I totally forgot about that. Completely forgot about it. 864 area code says, I saw Bad Boys for Life this past Friday, and it was awesome. A big twist and a lot of funny things. Bad Boys for Life is a must-see movie. Yeah, I don't agree. So, Michael Osaki is going to join us in just a few minutes, but speaking of sports, Tom, what are your thoughts on this that I'm about to talk about? There's a new petition circulating social media that wants to do away with the Super Bowl Sunday and move it to Saturday.
Hmm.
That's a big move.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been on Sundays forever. I don't know if it has ever played on any other day than a Sunday.
Yeah. No, it's always been on a Sunday. Always been on a Sunday. And it's, I think this is Super Bowl 54, right?
Oh, man, I've lost count.
It's 54, I'm pretty sure. Because I am the age of the Super Bowl every year.
Yeah, Super Bowl 54.
Right.
There you go.
And then I'm going to be 55, but when the Super Bowl, you know, at the beginning of the year, I'm still 54, so I'm always the age of the Super Bowl every year.
You've never lived a year without a Super Bowl.
That's right. So they want to move it to Saturday. I don't know, man. I think there's going to be a massive resistance on that.
I can see why, though, because so many people, the Super Bowl party is a big thing.
Yeah.
Is a big thing. People are eating, they're drinking. Mainly this is the problem, is that they want to be able to...
You got to get up to work for the next day.
Yeah. And that game goes fairly late sometimes. And it's not like watching Sunday afternoon football. This is Sunday night football.
And then they always try to have some sort of ratings grabber show afterwards.
Right. So you might want to watch what's coming on after the Super Bowl. I mean, the number of television programs that have debuted after the Super Bowl is countless.
Yeah.
Countless.
Including Family Guy.
Yeah.
Family Guy debuted in 1999 after the Super Bowl. According to a petition on change.org, the creator, Frank Ruggeri, a Rochester, New York resident, says if the Super Bowl were to move to Saturday, it would get more money and attract visitors to the game. He also believes that the NFL will get more television views because most government jobs will have the day off and more children will be interested as well. The goal of the petition is to gain 5,000 signatures. Four teams will face off. They did face off. So who is in this? It's the Chiefs and the 49ers, right?
Yep, Chiefs, 49ers.
The Chiefs and the 49ers are going to the Super Bowl. However, the halftime performers for the Super Bowl have been announced. That's Jennifer Lopez and Shakira. So.
Ooh, wow. Yeah, I wouldn't mind if it was on a Saturday, honestly. Honestly, I'd be more likely to watch it at this point.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's just too much of a tradition, man, to have it on Super Bowl Sunday, man.
You got a text from the 224, says, keep it on Sunday, but play at 2 p.m.
So earlier.
Earlier.
Started earlier.
That might take away from the whole primetime.
Well, that's
event
the thing.
Thing.
No, that's the thing. It's a, you know, it's a big primetime, you know, ratings boost. You don't want to start it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. Most parties don't even get going until around six.
Honestly,
when they have the Super Bowl parties, people, you know, show up at like two. By the time the game starts, everybody's half in the bag. So,
yeah, no, I think that's always been a problem that no one could ever really solve because it's become such a tradition. You have your Super Bowl Sunday; it's been that way forever.
Well, and Sunday is also a football day,
right? During
football season, Sunday you got Sunday, you got Monday, and you got Thursday.
Yeah,
okay, but Sunday is traditionally that when you think football, you think Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
At least I do. And I realize that there's Monday night football, and now there's Thursday night football. And those are, you know, very popular as well. But Sunday is football day. I mean, that's, you know, like people who watch, like, you know there are people who have the fantasy leagues who spend all day Sunday watching every game.
Mm-hmm. You go to church on Sunday morning, and wherever you are, you know, you go to church in Chicago on Sunday morning, it always ends with, all right, go Bears.
Yeah. So
that's always the thing.
I don't know. I don't think this would work. I don't think moving the Super Bowl to a Saturday would work, despite the fact that there is that petition. They want to get 5,000 signatures. Doesn't that seem like not many?
I don't think that's enough to convince the National Football League to
5,000 signatures. No,
move their signature event.
You're not gonna. I mean, that 5,000 signatures is not gonna make the Super Bowl move. I mean, it's been around for it's been on Sunday for 54 years for a reason. So. Well, it's 2 weeks, right? They always it's always 2 weeks, right?
Well, it's 2 weeks because it's gonna be played on the second. It's gonna be played on Sunday, February 2nd,
right? Because they always take 1 week off after the playoffs
division. Yeah, the championships.
Once we're all set, so it's the Kansas City Chiefs versus the 49ers. Is anybody rooting for anybody? You have a horse in this race?
Well, I kind of wanted to see the Titans get into the Super Bowl. That would have been interesting. But,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you caught any of the Chiefs game.
No, I didn't.
I mean, Patrick Mahomes is a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole team is really great. And then Packers got a spanking.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm not a big football guy. I didn't watch any of the playoff games or anything like that. But it was pretty funny to see what was on my newsfeed. All the Bears fans who hate the Packers, they were having a good time. So people were genuinely happy that the Packers lost, or at least people on my newsfeed were very, very happy that they lost. So, all right. Anyway, I don't think the Super Bowl should be moved to a Saturday. Just leave it on Sunday where it is. It's a tradition. And yeah. So, but the petition is there. It's at change.org. And if you want to sign it, they're only looking for 5,000 signatures if you're looking to support this move of Super Bowl being moved to Saturday. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it is a early Monday morning. Tom Hush is the producer. I'm your host, Nick DiGilio. And so if you want to check out the article, it's online right now. You can maybe if you want to throw your signature on there. All right. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to continue. Michael Osaki is going to be in studio with us from Baseball in the Attic. He will help you appraise any of your sports memorabilia. And so if you have sports memorabilia that you think is worth something, Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic, he'll be here to tell you if your sports memorabilia is worth coming up with here on the Nick DiGilio Show. And he will be here in studio, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200 with your sports memorabilia. And right here, continuing on WGN. We continue. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. As we continue this morning, it's a Monday morning. My dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Tom Hush is your producer, and I'm Nick DiGilio, your host. And we have a guest who frequently comes in. He was in the PPG Paints green room just now. And he is an appraiser, and he's been on the show many, many, many times. And he will appraise your sports memorabilia, and we would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. You can describe your sports memorabilia, and then our guest will appraise it for you. From Baseball in the Attic, we welcome back Michael Osaki. Michael, how are you?
Nick, it's good to be here, although I will say a couple complaints. Last time I was here, there was pizza for me in the green room. The time before, I had donuts. Mm-hmm. This time, I'm just stuck with hot chocolate.
Oh, well, sorry about that.
Yeah, maybe next time we'll get something for me.
Get something for you.
Yeah.
Michael Osaki, tell everybody about yourself and how you got started with this, appraising sports memorabilia and all that good stuff.
I got started in 1997 when my grandfather got me a shoebox of old baseball cards for my birthday. And since over 20 years ago, it's morphed into what it is today, where I'm a certified sports memorabilia appraiser. So I appraise things for individuals, athletes, professional organizations, museums, to help them assign value. It could be a baseball card collection that's been passed down through the family. It could be an item that someone wants to donate to a museum for a tax write-off. It could be a player, a World Series ring, just about anything sports-related.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing it for a long time now.
Very long time. I love it.
Yeah, and you've been on our show for some years now. You've been appearing on the show.
Probably about 10 years now, Nick.
Got to be, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, so we got a lot of sports stuff that we're going to be talking about, and you've got some events coming up that we're going to talk about, but we also want to hear from the listeners. If you've got, if you have something that you are wondering if it's worth anything, it's sports memorabilia, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Let's talk about the website, baseballintheattic.com.
Yeah, okay, so that website I put up for a couple reasons. One, I thought there was a gap in the marketplace as far as education, so I have a blog on there that I try and update as much as I can, although lately I'm not doing a good job of it, but very educational. A lot of times people have questions about if something, as far as an autograph goes, is it real or not? So I have helpful tips and tactics. I have some pictures on there from different things I've seen over the years or different athletes that I've met. So just really try and help people out through the website.
Mm-hmm. And you can also contact you through that website for appraisals, correct?
Yes, absolutely. There's a contact us form that people can click on there. Mm-hmm. And it'll go right to my inbox.
Okay. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. It's Nick DiGilio here. Tom Hush is here, and it's the Nick DiGilio Show for a Monday morning. And again, if you have sports memorabilia, we would love to hear from you, and we'll help you out. 312-981-7200. You've got some events coming up, right?
Yes. Next Monday, January 27th, I'll be in Skokie at the Skokie Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
I'm drawing a blank on the time. I think it's
7 to 8:30.
Okay, thank you, Nick. 7 to 8:30. And I'll be speaking for about 45 to 60 minutes on the history of baseball card and autograph collecting. And then afterwards, people that register, and it's free to register, can bring in what they have at home, and I'll give them a free verbal appraisal.
Okay. So that's going to be next Monday, a week from today. At the Skokie Library, and that's at 5215 Oakton. So there you go. You're also going to be on MeTV's Collector's Call.
Yes. Last year, I filmed two episodes for season two of Collector's Call. Mm-hmm. Basically, the premise of the show is the camera crew goes into someone's house or office where they have basically a massive collection, and they talk with the owner, and then they bring in an expert appraiser to assess the value of the items and the collection in its entirety. Mm. Season two kicked off, I believe, last week with the collection of Radio Shock Shock, Manco Muller. And I filmed two episodes, the first one being Sunday, February 16th. And then over the summer will be the second episode. So it was really fun to film. Both episodes were here in Chicago.
Okay. All right. You can look for that, too, at on MeTV. All right. We already have people who are calling in, Michael. Good. And if you guys you want to jump in here, you want to get something appraised, Michael is here to help. He's a sports memorabilia expert, and we'll help you out, find out if anything that you have is worth anything. So you can call us at 312-981-7200 or text us at 312-981-7200. It's Nick DiGilio show here on 720 WGN, and it continues with Daniel. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Hi.
Let me describe what I have. I have a black and white picture postcard. It's probably 60 years old. It's of Cub announcers Lou Boudreau and Jack Quinlan. It's autographed by them, and it's in very good condition, I think. Well, that's about it, unless you have any questions.
Okay, so Lou Boudreau.
Legend.
Yeah,
legend.
Legend grew up not far from here.
Harvey.
Yep. And his signature, he signed a lot, though. He loved just signing. He loved interacting. So there's a lot of signatures of his out there. Now, Jack Quinlan, that's a lot more difficult.
Sure.
So the Lou Boudreau signature, you may be looking at $10. But with Jack's signature, I would say between $50 and $75.
Wow.
Okay.
All right. And it's in good condition, right, Daniel?
Yeah, it's in very good condition. They're sitting in front of microphones. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's WGN microphones, and they're kind of like pretending like they're announcing a game.
Yeah, okay. That's very cool, Daniel. All right, well, there you go.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, announcers, is there an angle for them? I mean, do people collect announcers stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of them are quite rare or valuable. Obviously, the one that comes to the top of my mind is Harry Carey.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, a signed business card from Harry Carey or a signed index card could be $200 or $250.
He signed a lot, though, right?
He did.
I mean, he people loved him, and he loved the fans.
He loved the fans.
Was out all the time on Rush Street.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how stories people, I met Harry Carey, and I'll say where.
Rush Street.
Exactly. you know, after he was having a couple of drinks or cocktails, he would sign for people. But that's pretty great that a signed piece of paper is $200 from Harry Carey.
Yeah. Well, he was one of a kind. Harry was one of a kind. And, I mean, I can't tell you the number of stories that I've heard from people who knew Harry. He would be out till like 5-6 in the morning.
Jeez.
And just continue to stay awake. Like, you know, and then...
And I'm sure that day he had a game.
He probably did, yeah.
Now, Jack Brickhouse, the signature is more rare than Harry Carey. The signature value will be a little bit more than his, but not a whole heck of a lot more. It's just when you just walk around and say Harry Carey and Jack Brickhouse, people know them both, but everyone wants to talk about Harry Carey.
Yeah. Well, Brickhouse was not a slump in the drinking department either.
No, yeah.
And there's big stories about how those two guys used to tear it up together.
I would love to be a fly in the wall with those two guys.
Yeah. It's Nick DiGilio here. It's the Nick DiGilio show. Michael Osaki is here, and 312-981-7200. Tom Hush is your producer, and I'm Nick DiGilio, your host, and we're talking about baseball in the attic and getting some appraisals. If you want to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. If you've got any sports memorabilia and you're wondering if it's worth anything, here's Judith on WGN. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Nick. I have a very big picture of Vince Lombardi being hoisted by Jerry Kramer in color in 1968 at the first KFC championship game.
Okay. Do you know if this picture, Judith, is an 8x10 or 16x20?
It's 16x20.
Okay. And is the picture signed by Kramer and or Lombardi?
No.
Okay. So just the print is $25 to $35.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate
all right,
that.
Take care.
Thanks, bye-bye. Judith.
By the way, she did say KFC championship.
Not NFC.
I'm saying KFC. So the Colonel won. All right. We're going to continue with more. If you would like to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open. The text lines are open, and we're here to help you out. Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic. More appraisals coming up. 312-981-7200. The show continues. It's Nick DiGilio here, the Nick DiGilio Show on 720 WGN. Tom Hush is my producer, and we are here until 4. My guest right now is Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic. He is a sports appraiser, and he's here to help you out. Michael, welcome back.
It's always great to be here with you.
We continue on, and we received like a couple of pictures from listener.
Yes.
With what's the item?
Okay. This is, close your ears, some of you, this is a 2018 Green Bay Packers signed football.
Mm-hmm.
So the producer, Tom, handed me two sheets. The first piece of paper was the signature, the signed football.
Right.
And that was the first thing I looked at. And after staring at it for about 30 seconds, I'm like, these signatures look to be stamped. These are facsimile signatures. And then I put that down and looked at the second sheet. And it's a certificate of donation from the Packers. It says, the original signatures have been transferred to the football. So my conclusion is correct, that this is a stamped facsimile team sign, Green Bay Packers 2018 football.
Which makes it less, the less collectible.
Retail value, $25 to $45.
Yeah. Okay. Now, how can you tell, the signature thing is always, it's a tricky situation. How can you tell when it's not real or when it's stamped or, you know, how do you gather that information?
So I'll answer it. It's going to seem vague. It's just one of those things after seeing tens of thousands of autographs, you just kind of like know it. It's like when you walk into the studio, Nick, you walk in. You put your stuff down, and you have to fix your board here. And you just know what to do, what goes into what place. It's this piece of paper, even though it's black and white. They just it's all looks the same. They all look too. It doesn't look correct. Mm-hmm. Is the best I can answer that.
Okay, all right. Deanna says I have several T-shirts from the MJ era, youth and adult, some commemorating their different championships, and several with 45.
Okay, there's one T-shirt, I believe it's Repeat the Three-Peat, with the three championship trophies, and Michael Jordan's head is like a cartoon. That is a valuable T-shirt in all sizes, and that could be upwards of $100.
Why?
I don't know. It's a cute T-shirt. Maybe it draws people in, but over the years, that's always the T-shirt that generates the most value of all the T-shirts I've seen. Now she said she's got a 45, so that was after he came back.
Right.
Still, people would pay $45-$50 for each shirt. There is definitely a market for that.
Okay. All right. And anything with MJ on it is people love it.
It's gold. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Here's Mac on WGN. Hi, Mac.
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
All right.
Good. I was just calling in to see about some stuff to see if I could appraise it. I really don't want to get rid of it, but I was just wondering if it was worth anything.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, it's about a 10-ounce glass from Budweiser. It's a beer drinking glass, and it says Budweiser King of Brews, and it's got Cubs on the front. On the back, it's got Harry Carey. It's got like his hair, then a big glasses in his eyes and a nose. And at any rate, it says it's evidently after his death. I think I got him in the tavern. I don't drink anymore. About 1999 or 2000. And it has on the back 1914 and 1998. And it's Harry Carey's picture on the back, but it's done in blue.
Okay. The 10-ounce glass would be about 10 to 15 bucks. It sounds like you've other things as well.
No, I just had these two things. Okay. I'll just ask about it anyway since I had it. Me and my son used to go to White Sox Park, and they used to have Bat Day, Mat Day, Mug Day. I noticed 10,000 out there. I have a Father's Day Mug Day from that time. Is that any value?
Well, I guess if you're a father, it's worth $1 million. But, yeah, same thing, about $10 to $15 on that one as well.
Okay. All right, Mac, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Mac.
We continue. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are here until 4. Tom Hush is the producer, and I'm your host, Nick DiGilio. Michael Osaki is with us from baseballintheattic.com, and he would help you out with appraising some of your sports memorabilia. What did you get? What did Tom give you there?
It's pretty cool. Okay, so the first item I have is a signed Tom Brady football. It's personalized to Bob, and underneath Tom's signature, he inscribed it, Super Bowl 49 MVP. Mm. So this is definitely an authentic signature. The value decreases a little bit because it's personalized to Bob.
Right.
Right, so if someone was to buy it and their name is not Bob, it wouldn't mean as much.
Right.
But still, a solid signature. He has added the inscription. You're looking at about $500 for that signed football.
Wow. All right.
Now, there's a second picture I have. I don't know if it's from the same person. Probably is. Same. It's Tom Brady signed. This is the Super Bowl ticket stub.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, from 2015. He again signed his inscription, Super Bowl 49 MVP. This is about $300 to $350.
Okay. And this is the we got a text along with this. I went to the Super Bowl in 2015. I have a ticket signed by Tom Brady, MVP. He also signed a football for me. So there you go. Okay. Yeah. So that's worth some money.
It's cool.
Yeah. All right.
Great items.
773 sent in a text. And if you want to jump in here, if you got some sports memorabilia and you're curious as to whether it's worth anything or not, Michael Osaki is here. He'll help you out. 312-981-7200. Autographed Joe DiMaggio cover of 1949 Life magazine.
Okay, so when I think about some of the greatest ball players to ever play the game from way back when, I think about Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle. For whatever reason, in the last 5 years, signatures of Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams have decreased a little bit, while the Mickey Mantle has increased. Now let's talk about the medium. It's on a Life magazine as opposed to a baseball or a jersey or a baseball bat. So a paper item would be at the kind of at the bottom of the barrel. But a signed Life magazine, Joe DiMaggio, you're looking at $150 to $200.
Okay. All right. Why is it that some values of autographs go up and some go down?
Well, first off, it depends on if it's modern or vintage. Like if I think about some of the modern day guys, there are things ebb and flow every week, depending upon if they're injured or if, God forbid, they're caught with steroids or some other off the court. Now, with the older guys, Joe DiMaggio is a tough one because he was on the Yankees. So, he's on the same level as Mickey Mantle. Ted Williams was on the Red Sox, and so maybe it should be a little less. But I think Joe DiMaggio in the 90s signed a lot, but Mantle did too. But DiMaggio signed a lot more than Mantle. So maybe that's just today there is a lot more supply in the market and the demand is kind of petered out.
Okay. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is my producer and we are here with Michael Osaki. If you have any sports memorabilia that you're curious about, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. How about this? 815 says, NCAA basketball signed by John Wooden.
John Wooden's great, and he wrote a couple great books. John Wooden passed away several years ago. He signed a lot too, but a signed book would be about $50 to $75.
Okay, all right. Well, we thank you for that. And again, the website is baseballintheattic.com, and at any time people can just post their stuff there, and you can help them out.
Yeah, anytime, 24/7.
Okay. Did you read the story about the Sacramento Kings?
Yeah, it was interesting.
Tell us about that.
Okay, so the Sacramento Kings have, I think as everyone knows, the past couple of years, people are talking about blockchain and how to make secure transactions, financial transactions. And what they've done is, I think last week, they started selling game-used jerseys from Sacramento Kings players. and people are buying it through their blockchain technology. I think it's called Ethereum. And basically what happens is when you purchase that item, if you're the winning bidder, not only do you get the item, you get the game used jersey, but the provenance and lineage is kind of traced through this blockchain technology. And so it goes from person to person to person. So in 5 years from now, if you were to try and sell that item, then it's essentially kind of like guaranteed that this is the item that was purchased through Sacramento Kings. I like the idea because there's a lot of forgeries, kind of, I see it every day in this business. And a lot of times people will get an authentic certificate of authenticity, mm-hmm. but then they'll counterfeit it or make copies of it and kind of pass it off as authentic, and the buyer doesn't know. In this case, because you're doing it through Ethereum, mm-hmm. there really is no way to kind of counterfeit it, because if the seller says, okay, this is the jersey and I have this, it was purchased through Ethereum, here's the token, mm-hmm. The buyer would then have to, you know, get that token key. So that's the only way to really, you know, buy it on the up and up. So it's an interesting idea. I don't know if any other teams are trying to institute that or not, but this is the first I've ever heard.
Okay. There you go. That's interesting. That really is interesting. It's a platform for the listen to this, 5.4 billion sports memorabilia industry.
It's huge. I don't know what that I don't know how they got that number, but it's definitely in the billions for sure.
Man, oh man. Okay. Michael Osaki is here. It's Nick DiGilio, and it's the Nick DiGilio Show for a Monday morning. Tom Hush is my producer, and we've got people who are on the line. Let's continue to talk to them. Here's Mark on WGN. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
Like to know the value of a Topps Nolan Ryan rookie card. Very good condition.
Okay, that would be 1968 Topps. Nolan Ryan shared that card with Jerry Kuzman and a third player. So there's three of them on that card. The card over the past several years has been going up in value. Now, it's interesting. When you say very good condition, to me, very good is actually bad. But I assume what you mean is actually, you know, near mint or so. The card can range in anywhere from in an excellent condition to $700 to $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, depending upon how good the centering is and how good the corners are.
Yeah. All right, Mark, that's worth a lot.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. All right, we're going to continue. Michael Osaki is here. BaseballInTheAttic.com is the website, but we are taking some phone calls. 312-981-7200. We will continue to help you out right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are here continuing to do the show. Tom Hush is my producer, and I'm Nick DiGilio, your host. We're here until 4. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. Our guest is Michael Osaki, who is with BaseballInTheAttic.com, and he's here to help you out in terms of sports memorabilia. He's an appraiser and a collector himself. And we are here to help you out. 312-981-7200. Michael's going to stick around after 1 o'clock because we got a bunch of people on the line and we want to take all your texts and your phone calls and help out as many people as we can. So he's going to stick around till after 1 o'clock. I appreciate that. So 312-981-7200, is the phone number for talk and text and for your, requests here for your sports memorabilia. Here's Jim on WGN. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
Okay, I have a Mark Pryor signed jersey. It's framed. I have the certificate and everything. It's also got two pictures on the side of it in the lower corners of, you know, him pitching. And I've had it for, about 3 years. And I'll have to say it's in pristine condition because it's framed. It's behind plexiglass. It's very nice, actually.
Okay. All right.
So Mark Pryor, people think of him as being a pitcher for the Cubs. I really think of him as being a bank robber because when he got injured, you know, he, you know, got, I don't know, 75, 80, 100, whatever it was, $100 million, and that was it. And he moved to San Diego. I think now he's a pitching coach at some college, just living the life, you know, got $100 million in the bank.
Right.
So because of his injury and, you know, he was so hyped up, the value of his signature is really negligible. You know, jersey, ball, I mean, really anything. There isn't much demand, so I'm going to tell you $25.
Okay.
All right, Jim.
Thanks. Yeah, bye. Mark Pryor, man.
What a bust.
Man.
The hype was there.
No kidding.
All the potential, but... Mm.
I know. Every time I hear the name, I just go, ugh.
Yeah.
As a Cub fan, you know. We have some texts coming in. 414 says, hi, I have a football hand signed by the Notre Dame Heisman Trophy winners. This was sold by the university many years ago.
Oh, that's pretty cool. There's several Heisman Trophy winners there. Nick, you said it was a football?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, football hand signed by Notre Dame Heisman Trophy winners.
Okay, so... I'm going to say it's up and through the most recent Notre Dame Heisman winner. You're looking at $250 to $350, depending upon the bold and the strengthness of the signatures.
Okay. All right. So maybe $250, $300. Okay. Here's Warren on WGN. Hi, Warren.
Hey, how's it going tonight?
What's up?
I have a couple of Blackhawk team photos from 63, 64, and 65 that have practically every signature of every team member that was on the team then. There's Glenn Hall, there's Stan Mikita,
the Hall brothers. They won the cup in 63.
Chico Mackey, yeah. And the most interesting signature to me was on the 65 one, Phil Esposito.
Mm.
The one and only year I believe he was on the Blackhawks.
Right.
Those are.
I really have no any way to authenticate it other than I was there when they signed them. They're in a frame. There's yellowing on the white part, you know, the border. But other than that, no wrinkles. They've been in the frame for 40 years.
That's pretty cool. I'm sure you have a great story on how you got them. I would say the best thing to do is after the show, just send me an email of what they look like, but I'll kind of try and help you on air here. I don't really see too many team signed photos from that era. And the Blackhawks, I mean, there were so many great players back then. And obviously, 63 was a great year for them. And if it truly is a team signed photo for each year, 63, 64, 65, it could be upwards of $400 to $500 for each one. So, you know, maybe $1,000 to $1,500 there.
All right. All right, Warren. Thank you for the call.
Thanks, Warren.
708 sends in a text, speaking of the 62-63 Blackhawks program signed by Bobby Hull. Most interesting is that Blackhawks, in two words, wonder what they made it into one word. Also, an original 1963 Bears World Championship game ticket. It is interesting that it says Wrigley Field, time to kick off, price, seat location, but no date.
Okay, so a couple different things there. Let's tackle the first one, the Bobby Hull signed program.
Yeah.
So Bobby Hull in hockey is kind of like Bob Feller in baseball, where they just sign literally millions and millions of autographs. Bobby Hull is still signing. His condition is not that great, but you know he goes to every home game.
Yep.
Also, he does signings multiple times in Chicago every year. So his signature... on eBay, a signed Bobby Hull photo is $10 to $15. Now, this program from the 60s will be worth more, about $50 to $75.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second item is a 63 Bears Championship ticket stub.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so the Bears played their games at Wrigley Field until 1971, and then they moved to Soldier Field. That would be about, I'm going to say, $225 on that.
Oh, okay. All right. That's interesting. Suzanne from Wheeling says, I have a dollar bill that Ron Santo signed.
Interesting. I wonder how that even came about. I guess maybe she just, that's all she had in her pocket. And said, can you sign this for me? Ron Santo, Hall of Famer. Unfortunately, he got inducted after he was he passed away. But the dollar bill, you'll be pleasantly surprised, is worth more than a dollar. It's worth about $50.
There you go. It's Nick DiGilio here. It's Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is my producer, and I'm your host, Nick DiGilio. Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic is with us, helping you out with your sports memorabilia and doing some appraising. This person, Suzanne, also has a baseball signed by Pete Rose. Now, interesting, you know, because of Pete Rose's situation, does that affect his autograph?
So I just saw a couple of days ago, there was like on the bottom ticker of ESPN, I don't know how or why this came about, but the first time I've ever seen it, it said, Baseball Hall of Fame says that a band player, that band extends after his death. Because a lot of people were thinking that Pete Rose would be inducted after he passed away. The Hall of Fame now is stating, very clear, if you're banned, you're banned. It doesn't matter if you're dead. If you're dead, you cannot be inducted.
You know, it's interesting because the Pete Rose thing came up recently because of the Astros. Because of, you know, like how the Astros got away with stealing signs.
Yeah.
And I get, well, you know, and then Pete Rose is even saying, well, why am I banned? And, if, you know... Yeah. This should be lifted because, you know, what I did was nothing compared to what the Astros did.
Yeah. But going back to her question, Pete Rose signed baseball.
Yeah.
He signs a lot of different inscriptions. He had 4,256 hits. A lot of times he'll sign that inscription. That's usually the most common.
Yeah.
That's about $40. Sometimes he'll sign Hit King, Charlie Hustle. A Charlie Hustle is about $100. Sometimes he'll sign... I'm sorry, I bet on baseball. That's pretty...
No, come on, really?
Yeah. And that sells for about $150. he signs it Pete Rose, and then I'm sorry, I bet on baseball. So, yeah.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. All right. I wonder if anybody out there has a ball that's signed by Pete Rose that says, I'm sorry, I bet on baseball.
Well, if you do, call in. I'd love to hear from you.
Oh, that's crazy. 312-981-7200. That's pretty funny. He's embracing it.
Yeah.
You know? So, let's see. Here is Joe on WGN. Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
All right. What's up?
I have I got hockey gloves. They're professional grade, and they're in good condition, and they're autographed by Stan Mikita.
Okay. Each hockey glove by Stan Mikita could be $150, and it sounds like you have more than one, so $150.
Yeah, I've got the pair.
Okay, so about $300.
Good old stash.
Yeah.
All right.
Do you know where I could go, and can you recommend a place I could go and take them to see how much they would give me?
That's a good question because we should talk about that, about where can people go to get this stuff sold.
Yeah, there's a slew of different places, but when we're talking about autographs, anything signed, if you are in the market to sell it, you should get it properly authenticated by a third party. The reason why that's important is because the buyer needs to feel confident that what he or she is trying to buy is actually authentic.
Right. Okay. Hang on a second because we're going to go to the news, but I want to hear the full story and like where people can go. Michael Osaki is here, and it's the Nick DiGilio Show. We are live in the Skyline Studio here until 4 a.m., and more with Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic. We would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200 as the Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on WGN. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on 720 WGN. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Tom Hush is the producer. I am your host, Nick DiGilio. And right now, our guest is Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic. You can check out baseballintheattic.com. He is a professional sports appraiser, and he's here. And Michael, we are continuing the conversation. Now, before... we were talking about, where people can go and to get these things, to make sure it's appraised right and to get the money that you want. What's the process continuing?
Yeah. So what we're doing is we're talking about autographs. And what I was saying is If someone is in the market to sell, they need to make sure the item is properly authenticated because the buyer needs to be confident that what they're buying, what the seller is selling to them, is real and authentic. Mm-hmm. So there's some really good third-party authentication companies out there that do just that. Now, sometimes the seller may be hesitant to spend the money to do that, especially if they got the item signed in person and they know it's real.
Yeah,
that's great. But the buyer, you know, people don't like to trust people, right? Because someone could just make up a story. Oh, I got this signed by, you know, Babe Ruth or whatever it is. So it really is worth the nominal fee to get it authenticated, because you'll get that in the back end when you go try and sell it.
Right.
Now, as far as the venues go, when you're trying to sell something, there's a ton of stuff that's sold on eBay. One thing I like on eBay is you can click on a button that says sold items, and that shows you some comps, some good comparables, because a lot of times people see something for sale on eBay, and they'll think it's, like, for example, let's say I try and sell my home for $10 million. My neighbor is going to say, oh, my God, Michael's house is for sale for $10 million. Maybe mine's worth $10 million. But maybe the house sells for $150,000. Well, that's the true price. So on eBay, the same thing. People ask an arm and a leg for all these cards and autographs. But when you click on sold items, that shows you what the items have been selling for in the last 30 to 90 days.
Mm.
So make sure if you are on eBay, which a lot of people are, click on sold listings.
Okay. All right. That's good advice. All right. Let's see here. Here is Richard. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. I have a framed autograph of, or a framed picture of Pee Wee Reese with an autograph below it, but I was able to add to the frame two ticket stubs from Ebbets Field that I came across in my uncle's home after he passed away. It's from August 24th, 1951. Ironically, they paid the Cubs that day. The question I have is about the Pee Wee Reese autograph, but do those ticket stubs add anything at all of value?
A Pee Wee Reese signed photo is about $40 to $50. Each ticket stub could be $25 to $50. So the ticket stubs, both of them combined, are worth a little bit more than the signed photo.
Okay.
All right. All right, Richard.
Yeah, I just came across by chance. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
312-981-7200. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show. We are live in the Skyline Studio. Got some texts here. 847. We have 2013 Stanley Cup photos on Taves and Kane holding up the cup and a team picture in the middle. Both individual photos are signed. Number 132 out of 500.
That's a cool piece. $375.
$375. Wow. Okay. Very cool. Here's Peggy on WGN. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Nick. This is Peggy from Wrigley, if you remember me.
Okay.
Way back when I used to give you gum?
Yeah. How you doing?
Okay.
Good. What's up?
My connection to Wrigley, we heard one day that Ernie Banks was coming in to see Mr. Wrigley. So I ran across the street and bought some blank Chicago Cub balls from the Chicago Tribune store.
Mm-hmm.
And I got them signed by him.
Okay.
Late in the 90s.
Hey, Peggy. Yeah, Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub.
Yes.
A signed Ernie Banks baseball on an official league ball would sell for between $125-$150. Because it's on a Cubs ball, a little bit less. So I'm going to say $100, $125 for each ball.
Oh, okay.
All right.
All right.
Okay, Peggy, thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Peggy used to get me gum.
What kind of gum? Was it Spearmint?
She worked at Wrigley. So it was like all kinds of whatever, you know, they were making at Wrigley. Just like
Bubblicious. I don't even know what brands they had.
Little Juicy Fruit.
She worked right across the street from when we were in the Tribune Tower. So she was responsible for getting me a lot of gum, which was pretty funny.
Well, you owe her big time.
I do. Debbie says, do personal photographs have any value? We have a picture of Ron Santo on Wrigley Field. Of course, he is pictured with my 8-ish-year-old daughter, who is now 35. It certainly has personal value, but is there anything on the market like that? Do they charge, you know, for personal photos?
So today, yes, the modern athletes will charge for what they call photo ops.
Right.
$75, $85. But in this particular case, an unsigned photo of, with Ron Santa with a family member is worth more to the family than it is.
Yeah.
You, like, someone's not going to buy that.
Yeah, no. No, you're not going to buy a picture of Ron Santa with somebody else's family.
No, no, no.
Are you sure? Maybe I could get one with, you know, like, yeah, here's Ron Santa and someone's kid.
Yeah.
Who's the kid? I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. Ron Santa was a guy who he signed a lot and took a lot of pictures and stuff. I have a ton of pictures with Ron. I mean, I got to know Ron, and which is, I'm so lucky to have got to know him. He was a colleague, obviously, who worked at WGN with us when we were broadcasting the Cubs game. I've been up in the booth a million times, him and Pat. Great guy. Just a great guy. But he would sign anything.
You have a great job, Nick. You get to meet all these different people from all walks of life.
Well, Ron Santa was a hero of mine. And, you know, I remember the first time I went up to the booth to meet him, I was a nervous wreck.
Sure.
You know, because he's a hero of mine. I've been a Cub fan my whole life. And, you know, so I went up to the booth. I remember the first time I went up to the booth, I was just like, and he knew exactly who I was.
Really?
Yeah. He's like, and he was very proud because I'm Italian. And he was, you know, he was like, he's like, yeah, you're Italian, man. Make sure you get a good old Paisan. So is when he called me a Paisan, which was great. It's the Nick DiGilio Show right here on 720 WGN, and we continue. Tom Hush is the producer. I'm your host, Nick DiGilio. My guest is Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic. And if you have some sports memorabilia that you're curious about, Michael's going to hang out here for just a few more minutes. So if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Ron Santa, what is his signature worth?
Anywhere from 40 to 100 bucks.
Mm-hmm. Depending on what they signed, depending on what he signed?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. 773 said, I went to the Michael Jordan restaurant auction. I purchased a picture that was personalized by MJ, and I believe to be one of his trainers saying, thanks, and you're the best. What is that? Would that be worth anything?
I assume they mean the restaurant on LaSalle Street, which is now Gino's East, because
right.
Now they have the Michael Jordan Steakhouse on Michigan Avenue. A couple hundred bucks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple hundred bucks for that. You know, someone who ran a nostalgia shop in Wrigleyville on Addison,
He
passed away. Yeah. Tom Boyle was 88. I can't tell you the number of times. I mean, I grew up like blocks away from there. And he had a ton of stuff that, you know, at this place called Yesterday, right on Addison, not very far from Wrigley. But yeah, he was a legendary guy, and his store was amazing. It was loaded with stuff.
I loved stopping in there. I would try to go at least once a year, say hi to him, but just look around. I mean, you walk in and it's not really a man cave. It's like, I don't know. It's just like everywhere you look, there's something new.
Yeah.
It looks like the place is about to fall down, but it's not. And there's just so much stuff. And every time I walked in there, it was something different that caught my eye. And sometimes I would ask for the backstory, you know, oh, how did you get this? Or what's the story here?
Yeah.
He had a great memory, too.
Yeah, he was great. And, you know, like I said, I've been there a million times because I grew up walking distance from there. And I bought a bunch of stuff from him, too. He had everything. He collected everything. So...
what's going to happen now to the shop?
I don't know. I'm assuming maybe family members will take over. But he was a staple in Wrigleyville for forever. I mean, as everything, you know, it's amazing because you know how
it's completely changed.
Gentrification has happened in Wrigley Field, but that little store stayed exactly the same as it was.
You're right. Everything around the area has changed, but
except
not
for that,
that
store.
And I just saw, I think the Taco Bell was finally raised during the offseason.
Yeah.
That was like one of the last things to go.
Yeah, which is too bad. I love that Taco Bell. all right, hang on a second.
Yeah.
And if you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200. Michael Osaki is with us. He's going to be just with us for a couple of more minutes. So if we want to get something praised, now's the time to call or to text at 312-981-7200. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio. I'm your host, Nick DiGilio, and Tom Hush is the producer. And our guest right now is Michael Osaki from baseballintheattic.com. We've got another. I want to mention your event again that's coming up, Michael. It is January 27th. It'll be a week from today, and it's going to be at the Skokie Library, between 7 and 8:30.
Yes, and it's free, but you must register in advance through the Skokie Public Library website. And if you're going to come, bring something that you have, and after I'm done speaking, I'll give you a free verbal appraisal.
There you go. So that's a week from today at the Skokie Library at 5215 Oakton Street from 7 to 8:30 p.m., and bring something along, and he'll appraise it for you. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Just a couple more minutes with Michael. If you want to sneak in, we would like to help you out. If you've got some sports memorabilia that you're wondering if it's worth anything, 312-981-7200. 414 says, I have the baseball where Jonathan LaCroix hit a RBI double off of Chris Sale in the 2014 All-Star Game. It's an All-Star Game ball with red and blue stitches. I bought it from an MLB auction and is authenticated by MLB with a hologram registered with the MLB. What is it worth and how much would value change if I were to eventually get their autographs on it? Or should I not try to get it autographed?
As soon as you said a 414 area code, I knew it was going to be a Milwaukee Brewers question. Okay, so it's not autographed. So let me give you the value now, then I'll answer the second question. The value would be right around $100. If you were to get it signed, would it add value? I think a little bit, not substantially. It would probably add about $50 to it. So if you can get the autograph for free as opposed to spending $50 to get the autograph, I think that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there you go. That's that autograph getting on the ball. We've talked about this before. What are some of the more holy grail objects out there that people would like to get as a collectible?
Well, this may not answer your question, but the holy grail of baseball card collecting is the T206 Honus Wagner baseball card. There's about 65 or 70 of them known, and they range greatly in value, anywhere from close $1 million to $5 million.
Wow.
And when I say $1 million, this is like the worst condition possible. The card has been outside in the snow and the rain. It's been run over by semi-tractor trucks for 90 years. That card will sell for $1 million.
Why? Why is it so valuable?
Yeah. Okay. So some people think, oh, because he's a Hall of Famer. No, it's not the reason why. What happened was, these cards were manufactured between 1909 to 1911 and by the American Tobacco Company and inserted into packages of cigarettes.
Mm.
Now, what happened was Honus Wagner thought that when kids found out that his image, his likeness, was being inserted into packages of cigarettes, they would kind of, oh, wow, Honus Wagner is endorsing cigarettes, or maybe he smokes. And Honus Wagner didn't like that idea. So he called up American Tobacco Company and said, I don't want my image on your cards anymore. And so they said, okay, Honus, we understand your point. From here on out, we will no longer manufacture that card. But at that point, a lot of the cards had already gone out the front door and into different packages across the country. So here today, that's why it's so hard to find and so rare, because that printing plate was destroyed after that phone call, and no more cards were ever produced.
Wow. Now, how often did they combine athletes with cigarettes?
Well, back in the early 1900s, that was fairly commonplace. Another thing, cards came inside packages of bubble gum as well.
Sure.
Also, Cracker Jacks in 1914 and 1915, baseball cards came in them. And then a little bit later on, the 1940s, 1950s, cards were inserted into packages of cookies, potato chips, hot dogs, sausages.
Mm-hmm. I just remember, the baseball cards that you would get with the rock hard piece of gum.
Oh, yeah. Always a little thin rock hard piece of gum. It would like chip off your tooth. Yeah.
Greg says, hey guys, I have Walter Payton's autograph on a dated piece of promotional literature from a now defunct record store, Sound Warehouse. I met in the Schomburg store out of the blue. Does this have any value? It was in the mid to late 90s. So you just met him at a Sound Warehouse and got a
signature is $200. Walter Payton was the first professional athlete that I ever met. If you go to my website and click on photos, you'll see a picture of me and Walter from 1994.
Yeah. He was so beloved.
He was the best. Such a nice guy. Wow.
I remember I remember the outpouring of emotion when he passed away. I was on the air. I was on the air. I was filling in actually for Steve and Johnny. And when he passed away, and the phone lines, just everybody crying, like, you know, just could not believe that he was gone. People loved Walter Payton, and, you know, with good reason. I mean, there was such a long time where he was the only good thing on that field. Do you know what I mean? The Bears went through such a rough period, and, yeah. and but he was always, you know, astonishing to watch. And then finally, he gets that World Series, he gets the Super Bowl. They finally get him a Super Bowl. Yeah, but he's legendary. He's one of the most beloved, you know, people.
Yeah, and we just celebrate his 20th anniversary of his passing,
which is incredible to me that that was 20 years ago.
Yeah,
yeah. But I just remember just how emotional people were that night. I mean, you know, people were calling in and just like letting it all hang out and crying. So I'm looking at one of the pictures from your Baseball in the Attic, and it says seen several non-authentic Babe Ruth autographs in recent weeks. Yeah. This one you say is laughable. The owner had this elaborate story, but the signatures are not authentic.
Okay. I don't know what it is, Nick, but you know, I've been doing this business for many, many years. Always in January, I see a lot of fake Babe Ruth autographs. I don't know what it is, if it's like their New Year's resolution, we're going to try and sell our fake Babe Ruth autographed baseball item. This particular one, it was signed by, or supposedly signed by, Babe Ruth, Connie Mack, Ty Cobb. I forget who else was, maybe Jimmy Fox was on there. But it looked like they were all signed in a Sharpie, very slow, methodical way. It was no good. And the guy had just, you know, a long story. I was passed down in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to break the news to him.
No, yeah, it's no, it's good. Not. It's no good. It looks ridiculous, though. I'm looking at the picture from your website.
Right?
It looks ridiculous. I mean, I'm no expert, and it doesn't look real to me.
I post on my Facebook page, and there's a lot of comments like, oh, my God, this is one of the worst we've ever seen.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible. All right, Tom, my producer has a question for you.
Sure.
If you want to put your headphones on. There you go.
Yeah, so growing up for me, baseball cards weren't that big, even amongst kids my age that did play baseball or play a lot of sports. I mean, I was never much for baseball, but I played football, played soccer. But I wanted to get your thoughts on, is the new generation of kids growing up now, are baseball cards even going to be a thing for them? Are they even interested? And is there a future for the industry outside of the vintage and older collectibles?
Good question, Tom. I know it does seem glim and doomy, but every year we have the National Sports Collectors Convention. It changes venues. This past August, it was here in Chicago,
yeah.
And I've been going for many years. This year, I don't know what it was the most kids I've ever seen in the past 10 or 15 years.
Wow.
These kids were coming with their friends. I saw some parents literally drop off like 6 kids, and then they would leave, and they'd probably come back like 5 or 6 hours later and pick up the kids. These kids are 12, 13, 14 years old, and they really are going to be the future of this hobby. Now, to Tom's question, what were they looking at? What are they buying? They were looking at the modern stuff, not the vintage. Mm-hmm. They were looking at Luka Doncic basketball cards from Dallas Mavericks, Trae Young, Chris Bryant refractor cards. So, yeah, I was very encouraged. I was very excited. That was, for me, a key takeaway from that collector's convention where 40,000 people attended that. Wow, this is the most youngsters I'd ever seen.
That's encouraging.
It made me so happy.
That's very encouraging.
Yeah.
Okay, and if people want to get appraised, again, you can go to baseballintheattic.com.
Baseballintheattic.com. They can call me, 312-379-9090, or they can email me, michael@baseballintheattic.com.
Right. 312-379-9090 if you have anything that you wanted to take a look at to see if it's worth anything. And again, Michael will be at the Skokie Library a week from today, from 7 p.m. to 8:30, and bring something then, too, and he'll appraise that for you. Michael, always a pleasure to have you on, and I thank you for being with us.
Thanks. I'll see you next time.
Okay, there you go. Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic, and the Nick DiGilio Show continues. All right. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio, and we're here until 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and it's a Monday morning. And what's the music that you're playing there?
Well, that was a little Yes.
Yeah, nobody requested that, right?
No.
No. Okay, because it's Monday morning.
Yeah, Monday morning.
Monday morning. All right. Hey, welcome back, and we are here. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Continue to do the show here. So you know there was a whole TV show, a special about some of the issues that people had with Apu, the character on The Simpsons. And Hank Azaria says that he has no plans to continue voicing the character of Apu on The Simpsons, according to an industry blog. But that isn't to say that the Indian immigrant convenience store owner Azaria brought alive for 30 years won't live on. Producers and Fox Broadcasting Company wouldn't confirm to the Associated Press Azaria's exit or an end to Apu, a recurring character that has drawn criticism for reinforcing racial stereotypes. There was no immediate reply from on Saturday from Azaria's publicist. The actor, who is white, indicated Friday to SlashFilm.com that there was no resistance to phasing out his voice. We all made the decision together, Azaria said. We all agree on it. We all feel like it's the right thing and feel good about it. Apu, I can't... how do you pronounce his last name?
I'm not even sure. I think it's like supposed to be impronounceable, but I'll try to find out.
Runs the Quickie Mart, a popular convenience store in the animated sitcoms Springfield. Apu is known for his catchphrase, "Thank you, come again." Azaria's first turn as Apu came in the first season's episode, The Telltale Head, in 1990. Azaria speculated that among options going forward is transitioning Apu's voice to an Indian actor. In 2017, comedian Hari Kondabolu put out a documentary called The Problem with Apu that examined the character's cultural impact. Asked in the film's aftermath if he had watched the documentary, Azaria said, "Yes, thank you for sharing. Thank you for asking. Yes, of course, I did see it, and let me see if I can tell you how I feel about that. The idea that anybody young or old, past or present, was bullied or teased or worse based on the character of Apu in The Simpsons, the voice or any of the other tropes of the character is very distressing," he said, "and especially in a post-9/11 America, the idea that anybody was marginalized based on it or had a hard time was very upsetting to me personally and professionally."
So I do have a pronunciation, though, for his last name.
All right.
Nahasa Pima Petalon.
Oh, that's it, yes.
Nahasa Pima Petalon.
That's right. So it's interesting that, if they're going to keep Apu around, if they're going to, they should hire an Indian actor to do the voice.
I mean, it would only make the most sense.
And people, you know, I mean, obviously Apu's been around for 30 years on The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And caused a bunch of controversy, you know, back in that day. Did you see that documentary?
I did. I found it really interesting. And it's one of those things where it's something I never considered.
Yeah.
You know, watching Apu, I never really thought much about it. And I can definitely see why, you know, doing that might be considered stereotypical, just as much as when The Godfather and Goodfellas came out, they were really not received well by certain groups of Italian Americans. There was the whole Italian Anti-Defamation League that really was opposed to Goodfellas specifically.
I think the thing is, when if you look back at that and that when that documentary came out, and of course it could be offensive to people of Indian persuasion, you know what I mean? You don't think about it. It's just because it's this goofy cartoon character. And then, like, if you look at it, it's like, yeah, no, I can understand why people would be offended by this.
But I'm curious if does that extend to a character like Fat Tony?
You know, I know.
Voiced by Joe, but at least
Joe Mantegna.
It's voiced by Joe Mantegna, an Italian American, making fun of the existing stereotype.
Well, you know, I mean, listen, I'm half Italian, half Irish. Okay, so I've seen it all on television and in film. You know what I mean? I mean, it's either we're either in the mafia or we're drunk. Those are the big stereotypes. Irish people are drunk. Italian people are in the mob. So, But I mean, I don't know. I mean, isn't there also on The Simpsons? Isn't there like an Irish stereotype character?
Well, I mean, you could say. I don't know about. I think they've probably done it at least
once. Of course they have.
I couldn't, and maybe a minor character or something specific for like a St. Patrick's Day themed episode. But like Groundskeeper Willie.
Oh man,
Groundskeeper Willie is very stereotypically Scottish. He's angry all the time. He's a penny pincher, which is a stereotype a lot of people don't in the States don't know about Scottish people. They're considered very cheap, very tight with cash. And there's a great bit he does where he's like comparing, it's like enemies, you know, they're like cats and dogs, or the Scottish and the English, or the Scottish and the Irish, or the Scottish and the Scottish.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So it's just, it's one of those things where The Simpsons consistently makes fun of
everything
on its broadest possible level.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think my dad always found Groundskeeper Willie hilarious because he's like, that's so true. But I guess that's because
who does the voice for Groundskeeper Willie?
I'd have to check. I feel like it might be Hank.
I think it might be Hank Azaria. Because I know he did like a record number of voices for The Simpsons. I think Hank Azaria has the most voice credits on that show.
No, it's Dan Castellaneta.
Oh, it is. Yeah, him. Of course it is.
But it's spectacular. And
I think Groundskeeper Willie's hilarious.
Yeah, it's super funny. And I think there are people out there who have argued that Apu is funny because they in their experience, are like, no, this is exactly what my people are like. It's not for me. That's not for me to determine.
No, I know. Look, you know, we're white.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got it made. By the way, it's the Nick DiGilio Show. We are live. Here in the Skyline Studio, Tom Hush is my producer, and I'm Nick DiGilio. We would love to hear from you. We're going to talk about controversial TV characters. Who are some of the most controversial TV characters of all time? When you think about that, go back and look at some of the most controversial TV characters. 312-981-7200. Join us. Talk or text. We would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. The thing about Apu... I mean, I can understand why people would find it offensive. I have no doubt in my mind. But he's a really sweet character.
Yeah, he's
that's the thing.
One of the most beloved on The Simpsons. Yeah. And think of how many side characters get that much time to really develop their backstory and who they are, and the fact that he has a family and
a huge family.
I think they've done episodes about like him coming to Springfield.
Oh yeah.
And like his own immigrant's journey.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I don't think they ever tried to treat Apu with any spite.
No.
But they did take the opportunity to make fun of certain broad stereotypes that some people might not enjoy.
Right. And that a white guy was doing the voice was the big issue. So but anyway, that's a controversial character right there, Apu. So Hank Azaria is no longer gonna be providing the voice for Apu. And so we want to talk about controversial TV characters of all time. Here's a little intro to this topic. Television is still one of the most popular forms of mainstream media, and most people with success stories will tell you that they got their big break after they appeared on a television in some way, shape, or form. Reason being, it provides a platform for a much bigger audience. And even as we live in the era of technology, television shows and stations are not going anywhere anytime soon. In fact, they continue to get bigger and better, which is why most people who thirst for fame will do whatever it takes to get them, even if it means raising eyebrows for all the wrong reasons. Most successful actors, actresses, socialites, or in short, most celebrities admit that they did something controversial either on set or behind the scenes of a television just to grace our silver screen. Which actors played the most controversial roles? So here's a compilation of the most controversial TV characters of all time. And the first one here is the one that immediately comes to mind. Immediately. Archie Bunker. Archie Bunker, All in the Family.
Yeah.
I watch All in the Family, and it's amazing to me what they got away with on that show. Seriously. Obviously it's a great show. It's one of the best TV shows in the history of the medium. And Carol, everybody on that show is great. I remember the first time the first time I ever kind of realized what acting was when I was a little kid when All in the Family first came on. I was probably 5 or 6 when it first started. And I remember, this is when I realized what people, you know, like what actors do. I was watching Mike Douglas, and Mike Douglas was a talk show host. If you don't know who Mike Douglas is, Mike Douglas, very popular talk show host in the 70s. And he had a daytime talk show at like 3:30 in the afternoon. It was on. So I would watch it after school. And he had the cast of All in the Family on. So he had Carol O'Connor, he had Rob Reiner, he had Sally Struthers, and he had Gene Stapleton. And so I'm watching the show, and then Gene Stapleton opens her mouth and speaks and doesn't sound anything like Edith. You know, she had a much deeper voice. She didn't have that accent. She didn't sound dumb. And when she did that, I kind of freaked out. I'm like, what? What? Because to hear that voice come out of Edith's face was really weird to me. So that was the first time I ever realized, oh, she's pretending to be Edith. Because it's such a different, I mean, that's such an affected voice that she uses as Edith. And that was kind of the first time I ever was like, oh, I see.
Acting.
And the first movie where I realized what acting was, like good acting, like, oh my God, Dog Day Afternoon. I was 10 when I saw Dog Day Afternoon, and I was like, oh, okay.
So this is what
I see do. What's going on here. Still one of my favorite movies of all time. Never grow tired of it. I could watch Dog Day Afternoon on a loop. So when we come back, we'll tell you all about Archie Bunker from All in the Family as part of the controversial TV characters of all time. And we're going to continue here, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, controversial TV characters, and we continue. Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show as we continue. We're live in the Skyline Studio. Tom Hush is the producer as we continue with the Nick DiGilio Show. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. We're talking about the most controversial TV characters of all time. And we would love to hear from you, your thoughts. 312-981-7200. A couple of texts came in, 312. The writers of South Park and Family Guy have more guts than The Simpsons. You know, it's a different, I mean, South Park is a different animal than The Simpsons, though.
Yeah, those guys really are just total independence in every single way. And I mean, it's worked to their benefit in a lot of situations, but also it's gotten them in a significant amount of trouble.
Oh, sure. I have to say this. I think South Park is one of the most consistently great shows that's ever been on television. It's as good as it is now as it was when it first started. And they take a massive amounts of chances, and they push the envelope as far as you can possibly push it. And I think South Park is a great show. I think it's a great show. And it's still funny. And it's still biting, and they've not lost their edge at all.
Yeah, which to say about The Simpsons, which was had a great run, especially in the 90s.
There was a period of time when there was nothing better on TV than The Simpsons.
But, I mean, they're on, what, season 20-whatever?
30. They're going to be
30? They're going to be at 30 seasons?
I
don't know, man. I don't know if they can really keep anything.
Between, I wasn't going to say 91 and 97, there wasn't a better show on TV than The Simpsons. There wasn't. And that's a renaissance period, too, because Seinfeld was on during that time period. A lot of really great shows. But that stretch that The Simpsons had between, like, 91 and 97 is unprecedented for any other show. The writing was so consistently brilliant. It was so funny. 706 sends in a text. I guess this is like the voices of Amos and Andy being done by white men that are perpetrating stereotypes. I get that some folks don't appreciate that at all. Well, yeah, white actors played Amos and Andy in blackface. on television. So, yeah. And as stereotypical as you can get, the voices for Amos and Andy. So getting back to the controversial TV characters, Archie Bunker. Topping our list is Archie Bunker from All in the Family, the fictional character from the early 70s show, tops our list thanks to him causing controversy in nearly all forms, but mostly it came in ignorance and racism. He is regarded as a lowbrow blunt character who had the tendency of calling people names. For example, he tends to refer to his son-in-law as Meathead because, according to him, Mike has no brains. Bunker has never taken lightly by the public, and it's been said that he promoted rude culture by making it look cool and funny. Archie also frequently prejudices against specific groups such as blacks, gays, Hispanics, Catholics, and Jews. Granted, the show ran in the 70s, but there was no chance a show like this could run today. Totally agree.
But I think it's generally decided and looked at that the point of Archie Bunker was to explore those things.
Oh, no question. Yeah.
And that's what makes it so brilliant. That's why I think more people should watch All in the Family now, because it's so brilliant in the way that they use Archie to just say things that were on people's minds and, you know, maybe recontextualize things. Because isn't the Jeffersons was an offshoot of All in the Family,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And think of how important that was and how much their relationship was great to watch.
The thing about Norman Lear is that he changed television. He changed television. The kind of stuff that he wrote about, the kind of stuff that the subjects that those shows touched on had never been done before. Like, nothing like All in the Family had ever been on TV before. And Carol O'Connor is brilliant as Archie Bunker. He's absolutely brilliant. And he was, you know, Carol O'Connor was as liberal as it gets. He was as liberal as you can possibly get, this guy. His politics were so the opposite of Archie Bunker. And he's so good at it. And to have Rob Reiner be the foil, you know, to Archie Bunker is brilliant. All the characters on that show were great. And, you know, it was cutting edge, man. It was just like some of the stuff that you'd never seen before. Like the topics that got touched upon had never been touched upon in a sitcom? No. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show as we continue on here on the 720 WGN. Tom Hush is my producer, and I'm your host, Nick DiGilio, as we continue. Got some texts coming in talking about controversial TV characters of all time. 815 says, I know you said television, but Sacha Baron Cohen, a.k.a. Borat.
Well, it did originate on television.
Yeah, it did original on television. It did. 708, Ricky Ricardo on I Love Lucy, stereotypical Cuban character speaking in broken English, and I think it was the first mixed-race marriage on TV. Yeah, I mean, they were really married in real life, so. All right, how about this? You want to talk about controversial TV characters? Let's talk about Beavis and Butthead.
Oh, boy.
I love Beavis and Butthead. Love them. You know, when I was living with my friend Scott Oaken, if we weren't watching the Mambo Kings, we watched because when I lived with him, that was at the height of the popularity of Beavis and Butthead, because I lived with him in the middle of the 90s. So we found, you know, MTV did what they called a moronathon, where it was 48 hours straight of Beavis and Butthead. We got a few cases of beer, and like six guys came over, and we watched 48 hours of Beavis and Butthead.
I don't know. I don't think anyone could handle that.
You become Beavis and Butthead after a while. Just sitting on the couch. I love Beavis and Butthead. I love the movie, Beavis and Butthead to America. When they walk out of that church and they get struck by lightning, I swear to God, I bust out laughing every single time I see it. And I think Mike Judge is a genius.
Well, he certainly trades in kind of that level of humor at times. Well, still being clever. Like, Beavis and Butthead is clever.
I think Mike Judge is a genius. quite frankly.
Well, he used to work in like engineering, right? That's where the whole idea for Office Space came
from. Every Office Space is one of those movies that nobody saw when it came out, and now it's like a cult favorite. Idiocracy? What are we talking about here? I love him. And I think Beavis and Butthead are great. Due to its animated nature, Beavis and Butthead managed to stay on television, but we're 99% sure if these guys were real-life characters, this show never would have been on the air. In this cartoon series, the two characters tend to engage in delinquent and sociopathic activities, which made most parents of the kids they engage with the show loathe them, while their kids ended up loving them even more. For example, in one episode, there is a child who burns down his parents' house while his sister is still inside. And trust us, that's just one example. Beavis and Butthead was always under scrutiny because it imposed extremely sociopathic behavior on the kids who watched it. Although it has long been off the air, it has still left an imprint on some of the kids who can never be cleared. Yeah, it's true. the controversy when Beavis and Butthead first came on, I don't know, people might not remember just what, you know, what a stir they caused, those characters caused. All right, controversial TV characters of all time. Don Draper, Mad Men. If there was one television show which could not escape the feminist eyes, it's Mad Men, and it's mostly for its controversial character, Don Draper. The man was at the height of masculinity with a lot of money to throw around. In the series, Don Draper was constantly accused by the feminists of objectifying women, which he did. For instance, in one of the episodes, he tells one of the women characters that his only job is to give her money in exchange for things like sex and ideas. Don't think that would exactly play out in this day and age. That was taken wrongly by most people. In addition to John Draper being criticized by feminists, he was also on the receiving end of what most people consider his lifestyle and TV character as immoral, and also one that promotes violence, alcohol, and drug use. I think we kind of forget just how controversial Don Draper was and how Mad Men was. I think it takes. I think if you know, you got to look back at how groundbreaking and crazy Mad Men was when it first hit. So, okay, we got the news coming up as we continue. 312-981-7200. Controversial TV characters is the topic. The Nick DiGilio Show continues. I'm Nick DiGilio. Tom Hush is the producer. We're here until 4, live in the Skyline studio. It is Monday, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We have a very special Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's victory. Big, big night for Kaner. 1,000 points he's reached. Yeah, such a great player. So we'll do that. And we're talking about, and we want to hear from you, 312-981-7200, the most controversial TV characters of all time. And so we've been talking about that, and we want to hear from you, 312-981-7200, talk or text. Here's Roosevelt on WGNI. Roosevelt.
Hey, Nick, thanks for taking that call.
Yeah.
You know, when you were talking about controversial characters, I wouldn't call this guy necessarily a character. I would call him a freelance equal rights put-down artist, and that is Don Rickles. Remember all those roasts that they used to quote? They used to always invite him, and he'd meet how they would roast Dean Martin and all those guys, and he was absolutely tremendous. I really liked him a lot.
Yeah,
I
mean, Don Rickles was one of a kind. He was great, and the thing was, he could get away with saying all the stuff he was saying.
That's precisely my point.
I was going to say, because people loved him. People really liked him. And in real life, Don Rickles was a sweetheart.
Yeah. And you know what comes to mind when you mentioned Meathead and all that, Archie Bunker? It automatically clicked in my head. And years ago, before he died, my wife won tickets to go see him and Joan Rivers, and my wife went with her mother. Mm-hmm. And her mother was shocked. She says every other word for either one of them was F this and Chicos and Mexicans that and Puerto Ricans this
right.
and all he goes. So my because you know she had never seen him live, so she was really shocked because what he was on TV, TV was holding him back because of the FCC, I guess. But live, she goes, he's even worse.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Don Rickles, man, he was a legend. All right, Roosevelt, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Here's Ike on WGN. Hi, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man?
All right.
Yeah, I think I'm going to drop a big one on you. I can definitely see this character being controversial. This guy is like the opposite of what Dexter is. I just started watching this on Netflix, Penn Badgley from And You.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet.
Oh my God! You gotta check it out. This guy is twisted. It's crazy. It's a really crazy show.
Yeah.
This guy's the opposite of Dexter. I tell you.
Okay. All right. So that's You on Netflix. All right, Ike.
No problem.
Okay. It's hard for me to believe that Dan from Gossip Girl is a crazy serial killer guy.
I don't know. He kind of struck me as a bit of a serial killer on Gossip Girl.
Dan, he turned out to be Gossip Girl.
Yeah, I know.
Which I just love.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you, Nick. I'm glad that someone just, like, I just asked at one point. I was just like, who is the Gossip Girl? And they're like, but don't you want to find out yourself? No, I don't.
I love that it's Dan. I love that. Of course, you know, if you go back and.
It made no sense.
If you go back and look at, like, some of the episodes, like, where he is someplace and then the Gossip Girl is someplace that, you know what I mean? Like, they never really ironed out all of the complications that go along with Dan being Gossip Girl. I don't care. Speaking of Gossip Girl, have you seen the trailer for the rhythm section?
No. Wait, is it anything to do with Gossip Girl or just like...
Blake Lively's in it.
Oh, she's just... Oh, the movie, the rhythm
yeah.
section. Okay, yeah. I wasn't sure if it was going to be more Gossip Girl.
I can't wait. Looks like I can't wait. So, all right. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show as we continue through the morning. I was almost going to say Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks is my producer.
I should be so lucky to be Tom Hanks.
We've got some texts coming in. We are talking about the most controversial TV characters of all time. 312-981-7200. Text lines and phone lines are open. 847, the character Gregory House from House MD, played by Hugh Laurie. I think that show would have been shot down had it not been for the acting genius of Hugh Laurie and intelligent cast, crew, and writers. Hugh Laurie is the only actor who could have played that part. I totally agree with that. You know what's really funny is that he's so well known for House that people forget that his background is in comedy. And not that House isn't an amusing show, but like we're talking like Hugh Laurie is like British, you know, royalty in terms of comedy.
Like silly, like he always
ridiculous.
Played the silly foppish character.
Yeah, and he's hilarious.
Yeah, no, he's very very funny. But that listener is correct. That House is just he's just so mean.
I love him.
I don't know. Yeah, they managed to make it work, and it really kind of works on the back of Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, he's great in this show. He's great. 708 says Mike. Oh, this is Mike from Manuka. He said, "How about Hank from King of the Hill? Is Hank a controversial?" Is Hank Hill controversial?
I think he's a little bit like Archie Bunker in the sense that he says things that are, you know, of a very specific viewpoint that reflect his Texas upbringing. And he's a very, you know...
Is it just because he loves propane?
That's the most controversial thing about him. Yeah, no charcoal. Propane.
Yeah.
Propane and propane accessories.
Another great show. King of the Hill. So funny. I love Pamela Adlon as Bobby. .401 says Don Draper wasn't controversial if you remember that the show was set in the '60s. Yeah, I mean it was a different time period. But to have that as your lead character on a show, I realize that it took place at a very specific time, you know, in American history in the '60s. But to have that guy as your regular, you know, as your lead. Okay, more controversial TV characters. We want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. What about Stewie Griffin from Family Guy? I think the whole family. But Stewie's another example of a character who would never have made it as a real person. Because Family Guy is a cartoon, there's a ton more leeway. Although he is just a baby, some of the scenes which he is featured in cause chaos long after they've aired. Anyone questioning whether or not Family Guy is intended for children need only observe Stewie for about 5 seconds. For instance, in one episode, baby Stewie brutishly attacks the Brian, who is the dog of the show, for allegedly not paying him back. Stewie can be seen pushing the dog down the stairs, shooting him, and even breaking glass over his face. While it's intended to be humorous and make fun of violence, it in fact promotes it. According to most people, that not only promotes animal brutality, but also negatively impacts children as they tend to grow up thinking that violence is okay. Stewie has also been known to cross the line on numerous occasions, including remarks about terrorism, sexuality, and a myriad of other issues. Yeah, Stewie is one of many characters on that show, because I think Family Guy is loaded with controversial characters and moments. I think that's one of the things. That's one of the things that Seth MacFarlane is trying to do. I mean, it's kind of the whole gist of the show, is to see how far he can push it, and to see, you know, what he can get away with. He gets away with a lot too. Tom and Helen Willis from The Jeffersons are next on the controversial. Although it raised controversy, when you look at it now in the right perspective, Tom and Helen Willis left a positive impact. Up until this show's airing, you hadn't seen many mixed-race couples on TV, and these two were groundbreaking. Most people don't know this, but The Jeffersons premiered only 10 years after the law which prohibited marriage between black and white people was abolished by the government. The show was under scrutiny from people who felt that it was not right for such racially integrated marriages to take place. In this case, we can say it caused controversy for all the right reasons, and it helped reduce racism through a use of humor. I remember it was a big deal. I remember it was a big deal when Tom and Helen Willis were on the Jeffersons. I do. Okay, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Most controversial TV characters is what we're talking about. We would love to hear from you as we continue right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio show continues right here on 720 WGN. I'm Nick DiGilio, your host, and Tom Hush is my producer, and we're here until 4. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And we would love to hear from you as we continue. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk or text. We've been talking about controversial TV characters, some of the most controversial TV characters of all time. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Here's David on WGN. Hi, David.
Hey, Nick. Going back to the mid to late 70s, Mr. Bill.
What? Why would he be controversial?
There was some controversy as to the color. He was actually supposed to be dark green, but he looked black, and that I remember it caused some you know racial issues going on.
Oh, there. I don't remember that at all.
Oh, I do.
Okay.
But it blew over pretty quickly because the humorous aspect of it,
right?
Too, was,
right.
You know.
Okay.
But
right.
Speaking of SNL, didn't Andy Kaufman get into a lot of trouble at one point? Didn't he have like a real fight with
that was on the show Fridays. That was on the show Fridays, which was the ripoff of Saturday Night Live that was on ABC in the late 70s.
Sure.
Andy Kaufman was a guest on the show. And decided to be Andy Kaufman and just screw around. And so at one point, Michael Richards was a cast member. So was Larry David on Fridays. That's how they met. Michael Richards was a cast member on that. And Andy Kaufman was screwing up the scene that they were in. And Fridays was live, like SNL. It was live. So at one point, it just couldn't take it anymore because the cast members were just like, I can't, because he was just screwing around the whole time and not doing anything he was supposed to be doing because he's Andy Kaufman. And this is in the movie, by the way. They recreated in Man on the Moon. They recreated in the Milos Forman movie. So anyway, Michael Richards goes and grabs the cue cards and throws them at Andy Kaufman. Like, here, read your cue cards. Learn. Yep. So anyway. All right, David, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Carrie sends in a text that says, Ellen DeGeneres, her character on Ellen. Yeah, it was an incredible moment on TV when Ellen came out. It was it really helped a lot of people, and you know, caused attention to where it needed to be caused. So 404 says, would you consider Jackie Gleason from the Honeymooners? At the time, it was hilarious, but in today's time, he'd be controversial because of his threats of domestic violence. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm Honeymooners is like my favorite show ever, and I've seen every episode like 9,000 times. And in context, I can understand why people would be like, ugh, but you never take any of that stuff seriously when Ralph says it. You know, I know it's a little uncomfortable now, but the whole bang zoom thing, I don't know. You know, I never once, you know, took it seriously. I never once doubted how much Ralph loved, you know, loved his wife. So, 630 is Ren and Stimpy. Uh-huh. Yeah, I can see that. Ren and Stimpy pushed the envelope pretty far. John Chris Felucci, he's nuts. 224, Maude. Absolutely, Maude Finley, without question, is going to be mentioned in this article, without question. So, I mean, cut from the same, you know, they wanted to cut from the same cloth as Archie Bunker, but the opposite. Here's Neil on WGN. Hi, Neil.
Hey, how's it going, Rick? Nick?
All right, what's up?
Oh, called you Rick. Sorry about that. I had two characters, real quick. One of them was Detective Andy Sipowicz on NYPD Blue.
Sure.
I thought that, you know, that was about, well, it wasn't as controversial, though. And I was just looking at the name, and I cannot remember the name of Michael Chiklis' character on The Shield.
Oh, Vic Mackey.
Yeah, Vic Mackey.
Yeah, for sure. But,
yeah, that one definitely has to fall into that category.
Oh, no question about it. No question about
it. Supposed to be a cop, but he definitely was not the good guy.
No, he wasn't. Okay, Neil, thanks.
All right.
Andy Sipowicz. That's where we got to see Dennis Franz's butt on national TV. I don't think you were. I think you were just a baby.
Yeah,
when that show was on.
Yeah,
but we all got to see Dennis Franz's butt.
Well, you know, I can't say I'm unhappy I missed that. I think
a few times you got to see his butt a few times.
I think I can go my entire life without ever seeing Dennis Franz's butt.
Yeah.
And be perfectly satisfied with myself.
Yeah, no, he was a pretty. It was. I mean, NYPD Blue. You know, that was a good show, man. That was a good show. It was groundbreaking too. You know, in terms of content, in terms of what they got away with, it really pushed boundaries. And I remember it was very controversial when it came out. Not just his character, but everything about that show was. You know, was considered controversial. All right. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here. I'm your host, Nick DiGilio, and Tom Hush is the producer, and we continue. And here is the next person on this controversial TV characters, Murphy Brown from Murphy Brown.
Hmm. Controversial.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I didn't really watch Murphy Brown.
Yeah, actually. No. There were a lot of things. It was very political. At the time, Candace Bergen's portrayal of Murphy Brown was groundbreaking. Murphy Brown was a single mother with a successful career who maintained a balance between her career and motherhood. Some of the critics said that Murphy Brown was creating a bad picture to the younger girls who would go on against the moral values by thinking it is possible to get a child and lead a successful career, thus leading to broken families. Some of the people who criticized her role even included the then president. On the other hand, most feminists supported her, saying that every woman is allowed to choose her own way of life, and families come in many forms, and that's what really matters, is the bond and commitment. No, it became, Murphy Brown became a political, like, firecracker when she was on, when that show was on. Yeah, no, it was very, 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 stirred up a lot of problems. Dexter Morgan from Dexter. Perhaps nowhere more in the history of television did viewers root for a serial killer more than the show Dexter. In the series, Dexter was a man who has murderous intentions and who has devised his own way or code of killing people. While on the one hand, he's a sick maniac, on the other, you can't help root for him because everyone he kills in some way or many ways is horrible. Dexter would first torture his victims in a room which seemed empty, then slowly kill them in with a knife. Most of the decriers of the show claim that Dexter was promoting the rise of cults and serial killers in America. After a few years of the show running, more than three people were killed in the Dexter fashion.
I don't know. I never really got super into that show.
Me neither.
I know there are big fans out there.
Huge fans.
Huge fans of Dexter. And Michael C. Hall's great in it. Hated
the final season. People hated the final season of Dexter.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I watched it as a non-fan.
I watched it every once in a while. I'm a big fan of Michael C. Hall. I love Six Feet Under. Mm-hmm. And I think he's great on that show. And I think everybody's great on that show. I love Six Feet Under.
Yeah.
And that show ended, wow.
Perfectly.
Oh, my God.
That's how you end a show.
But yeah, I've always liked him. I just never got into, and I like horror stuff and scary stuff. I just never really got into Dexter.
There are parts of it that I found to be pushing the envelope of good taste, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just some of the, like, I don't know. There are some people out there that are really into true crime and specifically serial killers. And to them, I'm like, that's cool. That's like an interesting thing. Yeah. It is a strange world and a strange thing to look at and listen to and find out about. But watching him like wrap people in saran wrap and set up everything, I was just really put off.
It's a very disturbing show.
And very realistic.
Yeah.
Because he's a blood splatter analyst. So he's... It's very real.
Yeah, and Michael C. Hall totally sold it.
No doubt.
I mean, he was great. So, all right. We'll continue. We are continuing the show here, and if you want to jump in, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. The most controversial TV characters of all time, having some fun talking about that. And we will continue here on 720 WGN. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio. I'm your host, Nick DiGilio. Tom Hush is my producer, and we are here until 4. And we're talking about controversial TV characters. Who are some of the most controversial TV characters of all time? And we would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. Talk and text lines are open. And let's continue. Here's Jim on WGN. Hi, Jim.
Hello. This goes back to the 70s when Sanford and Son was a popular TV show.
Yeah.
With Red Fox.
Yeah.
Well, at Sportsman's Park, they would have a one night a month or so, or they would have a stage put out in front of the stands before the races.
Yeah.
And and Red Fox was one of the entertainers, you know. It was well advertised. There was a couple thousand people in the stands. I would say a half of the people in the stands were parents with young kids between, you know, average age was, say, 10. Okay, and Red Fox got up there on the stage, and he did his nightclub act.
Yeah.
Profanity, sexual. I've seen so many parents try to hide their kids' ears and get their kids out of there.
Well, yeah, Red Fox was notorious for doing a dirty act. That was his whole thing.
Well, the people didn't know. They seen him on TV.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a very heavy black turnout that night, too, and white. You know, because all the kids liked Sanford and Son, funny little show on TV.
Right.
And this a grandpa, okay, and when they had no idea what was coming.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. That's what I mean. Seriously, though, you might want to do a little research if you're going to take your kids to see Red Fox, because Red Fox was known for his filthy party animals or party records. Like, people would turn down the lights at a party and listen to these dirty, dirty records by Red Fox. I think it's hilarious that he played at a racetrack. That's ridiculous. So anyway, thanks, Jim. Controversial TV characters. You think Fred Sanford's controversial? I don't think he's controversial. I mean,
definitely Red Fox himself.
Well, yeah.
And I mean, maybe folks were a little bit. Well, seeing him on network television, no, I mean, knowing that he was a total dirt bird.
Well,
know?
Jim has a good point. I mean, a lot of kids and families watch Sanford and Son.
Yeah.
And you're at the racetrack, you would think everything's going to... And all of a sudden, here comes Red Fox, not playing safe at all.
I guess I never thought of the racetrack as a place for families, even though I went with my folks a couple times, but I don't know. Growing up, I just thought like, oh yeah, racetrack. That's where guys go to smoke cigars and drink brandy and bet on horses.
No, it depends on what track.
That's true.
It depends on the track you go to.
Like Arlington. Arlington is
family friendly.
Yeah.
You got picnic areas and all that stuff.
That's true.
Balmoral, not so much.
No?
Maywood, not so much.
Those are the guys in green jackets just getting loaded.
Oh yeah. I mean my dad played the ponies a lot. So I was at the track a lot when I was a kid. You know what I mean? Like a lot in the '70s. We'd go to Sportsman's, he'd go to all of them. But yeah. They're not. Arlington is like a night and day between the stuff that the tracks that we would go to in the '70s.
Man, if only I could have seen that.
It was something, man. It was something. I mean, I was a little kid, and I was exposed to the horse tracks at a very young age. My dad hadn't played the ponies in a long time. Did you ever go to an OTB?
What is an OTB?
Off track betting.
Oh no. No.
It was where you could bet on the horses and not at the track.
Well, the only person in my family that really bet on horses is my Uncle Ron, but he lives in he's Scottish,
mm-hmm.
and horse gambling has always been like big and legal and above bar. There is no off-track betting because everybody just does it through the
off-track
local.
Betting. There used to be an off-track betting right next to the Chicago Theater on the corner of State and Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And
seedy?
Not really. No. I mean, some OTBs were, but yeah, you could vote. You could basically bet on anything. Like there are like four different racetracks that are going, and you could bet on any horse at any time. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You got a little lunch hour. Let's go blow some money.
Real
on the horses. Yeah. So. All right, it's the Nick DiGilio Show as we continue right here on 720 WGN. Tom Hush is my producer. I'm your host, Nick DiGilio. Let's get back to it. Here's Pat on WGN. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
What about Charlie Harper from Two and a Half Men?
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, even his brother, too, but
yeah,
mostly Charlie.
Yeah. I've never seen an episode of that show all the way through.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I know I watch sometimes with my wife, and she kind of gets disgusted and leaves the room. But
yeah, I can understand that. I can understand that. It's okay, thank you. Thanks, Pat.
All right.
You know, it's funny because it's on in the middle of the night here. They show it on Channel 9 in the middle of the night. And I will say this about the show. You ever watch Two and a Half Men?
My dad used to watch it religiously. I literally have a Charlie Harper-style shirt that he used to wear.
The bowling shirt?
Yeah, the bowling shirt. I've got it in my closet right now.
Here's the one thing I will say about that show. A lot of attractive ladies on that show. Every episode, every episode, I get distracted here in the studio because it's on and I'm going, whoa.
Well, that was like the whole thing with his character, with Charlie Sheen's character, was that he was a ladies' man.
No, I understand that. It's just that it's like, wow.
No,
like every episode, it's like, whoa.
Yeah, very good casting.
Yeah.
Very good casting.
715 sends in a text, and you can send in a text as well. 312-981-7200. Desilu Studios created due to the prejudice against Ricky that no one would produce the show. That's right. He and Lucy made Desilu out of necessity because nobody wanted to hire him. So they made their own studio. And Desi Arnaz is essentially responsible for the three-camera sitcom. He's the one who's basically responsible for that style of sitcom. You know, in front of the studio audience with the different cameras. That was all Desi. 309 says, wasn't the 1970s comedy Soap controversial? Yes, it was. Very. I remember a lot of the kids at school weren't allowed to watch it, and I was always told, because I watched it, and they were all jealous of me.
My mom lets me watch Soap.
Yeah. Well, you don't understand. That was a very controversial show.
Yeah.
It really was. It had a warning at the beginning. You know, to, you know, like sensitive viewers, and not now you see that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think Soap might have been the first show
to ever do that.
To ever do that. And also, the character that Billy Crystal played, Jody, was one of the first openly gay characters in TV.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Absolutely. Wow. And I mean, they just didn't do that back in the 70s. And then it was really groundbreaking for Billy Crystal to play that character.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I grew up in a time where violence was just on the rise in TV. I feel like most of the TV shows I saw were fairly violent or push the envelope of violence.
In the 90s?
Well, yeah, late 90s, early 2000s, when things really started to turn a corner and the golden age of TV started, like, because I remember The Sopranos. That was at my school. If you were allowed to watch The Sopranos, you were cool.
Yeah.
Because I was not allowed to watch
The Sopranos. The Wire debuted in 2002.
Yeah, The Wire wasn't really talked about amongst school children because it wasn't mobsters.
No. I wouldn't imagine a lot of school children watching The Wire. I got to get home from school because I got to watch The Wire.
Guys, I got to watch The Wire.
I got to see what's going on with McNulty and Bunk. 715 area code, controversial. Monty Python, the whole show. Well.
Talk about breaking down cultural norms.
Yeah. I remember, you know, I told you this story. My dad's the one that got me to watch Python. And my mother never got it. My dad and I would sit there and laugh our butts off at Python. My mom would just kind of sit there and shake her head and say, I don't get this at all.
I mean, it is a justifiably insane television program.
It is brilliant. I mean, I love Monty Python. That goes without saying. All right, you ready for another controversial TV character? Okay, here's a character that I adore. I adore this character. Al Bundy from Married with Children. I love Al Bundy. Al Bundy is one of the most popular guys in sitcom history. However, that didn't come without a huge amount of controversy. Most people called Al a modern-day Archie Bunker, a working-class stiff who had nothing better to do than rag on most people in society. In Al's case, he was always guilty of putting down the opposite sex, degrading them, and also making fun of the lower class, a class that he was in. Albeit the show was a comedy and never intended to harm these groups, feminists were all over Married with Children. If you go back and watch the show now, you'll understand why it could never be aired in modern day.
Even though it is, regularly.
Even though it is. And why am I blanking on the actor's name? Ed O'Neill. Genius. Ed O'Neill's a genius.
And, I mean, he got hired to be in Modern Family because he was Al Bundy.
Yeah.
You know, I think
Ed O'Neill's great. I think the whole cast of Married with Children is great. Katie Sagal, so hilarious.
Christina Applegate.
Great. Faustino.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the way around. But Amanda Bierce was fantastic on that show. But the key to that show was Ed O'Neill.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was the key.
It took me a long time to get why that show was funny. Because it would come on reruns all the time when I was growing up.
It was also on this new weird channel, Fox. Like, it was it was the fourth network, and that's what they were, and they only had like three shows. They had like America's Most Wanted, and they had Married with Children. And it caused a lot of controversy, Married with Children, a lot, when it first came on.
Just because of the depiction.
Because of the content.
Just marital unhappiness?
Well, I mean, also very mature content. Like, they were really pushing the envelope in terms of content. I remember. And it was just, nobody knew what was going on because the Fox was brand new. This was like the big fourth network, Fox. And this was kind of the only show that they had. Here's this weird network called Fox that's showing this really edgy, really out there sitcom. And it caused a lot of controversy. And also, it was one of those deals where, if you go back and watch Married with Children, now you go back and watch it, the studio audience with Married with Children was really unusual because they were loud, they were obnoxious.
You got a rowdy bunch.
Yeah, no, seriously. They would woo, you know, do that kind of stuff. And you didn't see that, really. And the audiences weren't like that with other, you know, live sitcoms. So everything about that show was just a little bit, what's going on here? We're on this weird network. this family hates each other.
That was the part that got to me a little bit. I guess maybe when I was growing up, I was just kind of wanted them to like each other. And I'm not, you know.
I mean, ultimately, they
I was trying to escape my own family that was. I'm not saying that our family didn't like each other, but it was a lot of scraps and a lot of fighting all the time, a lot of shouting and yelling. I was like, the last thing I need is to turn on TV and I have to watch this really just unhappy family just be unhappy for 30 minutes.
Right. But it's just, I don't know.
Clearly, I was in the minority.
Here's the one thing that always used to make me nuts about Married with Children is that, I realize that the reason why this happens in the show is because they're married, but I never understood why Al didn't want to have sex with his wife, because Katie Sagal is hot. Peg Bundy is a babe. And so I would always be like, how do you not want to have sex with your wife? Look at her. Look who you're married to. But of course, the idea is that they're married, and that's why he doesn't want it. You know, that's my wife. I don't want to have sex with my wife, even though she's unbelievably beautiful. All right, we continue. It's Nick DiGilio and the Nick DiGilio Show on this Monday morning as we continue to move forward. And Tom Hush is my producer, and I'm your host. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN. We've been talking about controversial TV characters, having some fun with that. And let's see, here's Chris on WGN. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, Nick?
All right, what's up?
Fine. I just couldn't help with y'all talking about Al Bundy and Married with Children.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember, like, the first two seasons when it first started, it was like a Cosby Show, Fresh Prince, Family Matters type sitcom.
Yeah.
And because, you know, Kelly was the only person that got grounded and punished, and Bud wasn't, because she used to sneak off and do all those grown stuff.
Yeah.
And also, when it hit syndication, it came on late at night on my Fox affiliate, and rarely CBS affiliates played at night.
Yeah, they still show Married with Children in the middle of the night. It's on at like 4 o'clock in the morning, right?
Yeah, it's on.
Like TBS or something like that?
It's. I think they bought it. I think they bought the syndication rights, and they show it like pretty much all throughout the overnight.
Yeah.
So if you ever can't sleep, you can hang out with Al Bundy.
Hang out with the Bundys.
Oh God, what a terrifying prospect.
But no, it was a big deal, Tom, when that show first aired. You know, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that like nobody could make heads or tails out of this Fox thing. Nobody thought it was going to last, you know, and it did, and the show became a master, you know, a monster hit. So. All right, Chris, thank you for the call. Here's Thomas on WGN. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, good morning, Nick. How are you?
All right, what's up?
I wanted to make mention of two 70s personalities. The first one would be Chuck Barris from the original Gong Show.
Yeah.
You could never tell if he was sober or if he was extremely high. He never looked at the camera. He always looked off into the distance.
Yep. And, you know, they made a movie out of his life.
Right.
Confessions of a... What's
Dangerous
it called?
Mind.
Dangerous Mind with Sam Rockwell.
And he was always hilarious, of course.
Yep. What was the other one?
The other one was the early 70s documentary series on ABC called Family. I think that was the name of it, because there was a later Family scripted show. But it was a documentary series that followed the California family.
Yeah, it was called American Family.
Right. And they basically got a divorce because of the TV show, the parents in the show.
Yeah, it's true.
That's true.
Yeah. All right, Thomas, thanks for the call. I remember American Family. That was like the precursor for all the reality stuff that's out now.
Yeah, and it's I've seen some footage of it. It's pretty odd to watch.
It is.
It's very strange that they would refine that into the modern reality show.
That was the very first one that they did. And That inspired Albert Brooks' first feature, Real Life.
I mean, how could it not, you know?
You've seen Real Life, right?
Yeah.
I love the Ettenhowers. That's my favorite, those stupid cameras. The Ettenhowers, they had the big stupid helmet over their heads. Harry Shearer is the camera operator in the movie. You're not a failure. When he's got the stupid... These are the Ettenhowers. You've read the literature. All right. It's the Nick DiGilio Show continuing right here on 720 WGN. Tom Hush is the producer. I am your host. 312-981-7200. All right. How about Jack Bauer, 24? How many people does he kill?
A ton. Like a million. Like a million people.
He kills like 8,000 people in one episode. I'll tell you something. I gave up on the show when he killed a guy with a pencil.
See, that's when I would sign on. I'd be like, all right, now we're getting into interesting territory.
And when Elisha Cuthbert was trapped by a mountain lion, I was like, okay. Because I thought the first season of 24 was great. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I thought the concept was really cool. It was really well done. Mm-hmm. And Kiefer Sutherland's a badass. You know what I mean? Like, that's his signature role. He's always going to be Jack Bauer. Not the dude from the Lost Boys. You're eating worms, Michael.
I mean, how many times does he say that he's like suspending the Constitution or like suspending the law just to kill a guy?
Yeah. Jack Bauer was known as one of the toughest television characters of all time. However, it didn't come without controversy. While Bauer seemed invincible, his flaw was doing anything and everything to get what he needed. Oftentimes that included torture and fierce torture at that. In virtually every episode, Jack is involved in highly violent activities that involve murder and inhumane torture to his enemies that just get in his way. His interrogation techniques were widely criticized. Critics said that displaying such a character tends to motivate violent activities by law enforcement on their victims. Yeah, that was a big deal. I remember how much controversy it caused. But the setup for the show was so original. You know, I've never really seen anything like that. Like, every episode is just 1 hour in the day of Jack Bauer. But, of course, a lot of people were like, all right, when does he go to the bathroom? he's got to take a bathroom break at some point. Can't go 24 hours without going to the bathroom. All right, how about Peter Griffin and Family Guy? We already had Stewie on the list. Now it's time for Peter. Peter Griffin is another character on Family Guy who causes all hell to break loose with each episode. Peter tends to make fun of everything while at the same time is oblivious to nearly everything. He verbally and physically abuses both son and daughter and has zero concern for societal convention. In classic Seth MacFarlane fashion, in one episode, Peter goes over the top and makes fun of people with the Parkinson's disease, while in another, he mocks those with Down syndrome. Peter does not stop there, and instead he goes on to mock a patient who just found out he has AIDS. Instead of waiting for the doctor to take the news to him, Peter and a group of other guys rush in to tell him that he not only has AIDS but full-blown AIDS, something which crushes the hope of the victim and also his health to plummet. Remember, folks, that's just one episode.
Yep. Yeah, the barber, he brings, it's a barbershop quartet, and they sing him. That show really toes the line of taste.
No, there's no question.
I won't lie. I stopped watching it.
Did you?
Yeah, because it just stopped being, it stopped being really funny. But my dad watched it literally every night because I think Channel 9, WGN-TV, used to have, they used to show that and 2.5 Men. And God help our house if that chicken fight came on. If it was an episode where he fights a chicken.
Yeah. I mean, that you can't deny that that's hilarious. I mean, it's a running gag. It's on not just one episode.
Yeah, no, it just keeps going.
But him to beat the crap out of each other, I mean, it's hilarious. I don't know. I think Family Guy's funny. I think it's funny. Sometimes it crosses the line, I agree. You know what I mean? Sometimes it goes a little too far, but ultimately I think it's a funny show.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Trucker Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Nick. Hey, as a side note, just let you and the rest of the listeners know, 8094 is a ice skating ring with black ice.
Uh-oh.
But Fox and FX had another full-blown controversial program, Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, yeah, of course. Speaking of Katie Sagal.
Yes, and she was one of the ringleaders of it, who actually killed her daughter-in-law when she thought she turned into a narc for the feds.
Yeah. And by the way, she was, in real life, Katie Sagal was married to the guy who created it.
Right.
Yeah.
And they also had the one guy in prison was actually the former president of Hell's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they were. It was pretty much out there, but when you sit back and look at it, it was what was that big play of Macbeth?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, right down to son killing mother, right. Son killing father, right. You know, so.
All right, okay.
Yeah, it was out there.
All right, thank you, Rich. Right. Take care. Yep,
take care.
He said the name of the Scottish play, man.
Come on. Come on, you can't. I'm still blown away that you are afraid to say.
I will not say it.
All right.
It's the Scottish play. I won't say it. All right, let's continue. We've got more TV shows that are controversial and TV characters that are controversial. Phone lines and text lines are open, 312-981-7200. That's coming up right here on 720 WGN. It's Nick DiGilio. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on a Monday morning here until 4 a.m. I'm Nick DiGilio. My producer is Tom Hush, and we are here, and we continue. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We've been talking about controversial TV characters and the most controversial TV characters of all time. My dad's going to call in a little bit and tell a joke because it's a jokey time on a Monday morning. We are going to play back the Blackhawks Express from last night's victory. A big night for Patrick Kane as he joins the league of 1,000-point scorers in the NHL. So it was great that he did it at home. His folks were in the crowd, and it's a wonderful moment, and we'll play back the Blackhawks Express from that. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, and again, we've been talking about controversial TV characters. What are the best, biggest ones of all time? 312-981-7200. So we got some text coming in. 708 says, Mary Hartman. You familiar with Mary Hartman?
I'm not familiar with Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman.
Mary Hartman was a Norman Lear production. It was a syndicated show that was on Channel 32 back in the 70s, and it starred Louise Lasser as Mary Hartman, and it took place in a fictional town called Fernwood, and it was basically a satire of soap operas. But again, this is another really edgy show with Norman Lear pushing the envelope with in terms of what the content was, and it became a really big cult hit. And again, it was another one of those shows that had a warning beforehand that said this is not, you know, it's not good for young kids or anything like that. Of course, I watched it. And there was a spinoff that happened because the show became very, very popular. But they had this show called Fernwood Tonight. Fernwood Tonight was a fake talk show featuring Martin Mull and Fred Willard, and they played these people in Fernwood, and they would bring out characters, you know, they'd bring out actors playing characters who lived in Fernwood who were guests on the show. And that talk show, the Fernwood Tonight Show, took off so much that they actually did another spinoff called America Tonight with Fred Willard and Martin Mull. And I loved that show. Fernwood Tonight was a great show. But Mary Hartman was again pretty controversial because of the content of it, and you know, I mean, that's how I discovered Fred Willard and Martin Mull, and there was lots of great cast members in it, but it was a weird show. It was a really weird show.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it was strange. Didn't have a laugh track. It was shot on video. It wasn't shot on film, but it didn't have a laugh track. And it was it became a cult. It became a huge cult hit. Deborah Lee Scott was in it, who would go on to be in Angie with Donna Pescow. But yeah, no, it was on at 10 o'clock at night. It was on every night at 10 on Channel 32, which is an odd time for a show to be on. And I remember we watched it every night, and it was just so weird. But yeah, Mary Hartman. Controversial, definitely a controversial TV show. We're talking more controversial TV characters. And we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 as we continue. And it is the Nick DiGiulio Show this morning. 708 says, Frank Gallagher in Shameless. Yeah. And that's, I think it's entering its last season. This is, I think, the final season of Shameless.
I believe so.
I think we're entering into the final season of Shameless.
It's certainly gone on longer than the original show from the UK.
Yeah.
Because that was maybe 3 to 4 seasons.
That's the case with all the shows that are based on British shows. What, The Office had 2 seasons and the Christmas special?
Yeah.
That's it. How long did The Office run in America? The American version.
Oh, God.
It's got to be like 15 seasons, right?
No, 15? No. Not 15.
It's over 10?
Nine. 9 seasons.
Oh, I thought it was more than that.
Yeah, it was 9 seasons for The Office, 7 for Parks and Recreation. That's how I always remember those.
Oh, okay.
But I will say, yeah, the final season of Shameless, I said to this will be the next season will be the final one.
Okay.
Yeah.
815, Roseanne Barr. Yeah. The thing about the show Roseanne is that when it first, I mean, it was a groundbreaking show. We've talked about this before. It was a groundbreaking show. The very first, episodes of those shows. And then when it came back just recently and she caused all that controversy and then left the show. Yeah. But 708 says not so much the man, but the show, Benny Hill. My dad would crack up every time he slapped that old man on the head repeatedly. The whole my dad would fall off the couch laughing. The little old dude. And then Benny Hill, I'm not as big a Benny Hill fan as I am some of the other British stuff. I think Benny Hill's fine. It was funny. There were a lot of lovely women on it. And you got the old guy getting slapped on top of the head repeatedly. And you got the fast motion stuff.
That'll never not be funny.
But I was obviously more of a Python guy. That's just on a whole different level. Benny Hill was just really silly. And I laughed at it. I watched it. But it's just not on the same level as some of the other British comedies that I loved. Love Dave Allen at Large. Thought that was great. So, the two Ronnies. Gotta love the two Ronnies. Ronnie Corbett. What's the other one's name?
Oh, geez.
Ronnie Corbett and Ronnie, I don't remember.
I haven't watched the two Ronnies in forever.
Oh, yeah. I used to watch all the time.
From Barker and Corbett.
Yeah, that's Ronnie it. Barker, right? Ronnie Barker. I love those guys. All right, now we're also the controversial TV characters of all time. My buddies Ren and Stimpy are part of the article from the Ren and Stimpy show. Amazingly, these two characters were a cartoon which aired on Nickelodeon of all stations, eventually then MTV, and was allegedly banned thanks to their highly graphic sexual content, which should obviously not be on a kids program. Also, people claimed that it included dark content, which added no educational value to children that cartoon shows should entail. Generally, cartoons are specifically meant for children, while Ren and Stimpy came nothing close to that. Cartoons should include hilarious and educational scenes that can amuse kids and have some time to educate them. If it weren't for Nickelodeon, Ren and Stimpy might have pulled it off. I vividly remember the first time I encountered Ren and Stimpy. It was at an animation festival, a screening of an animation festival that was going to play at the Music Box. And it was the very last. And you know how these animation packages, Tom, sometimes they're a mixed bag. Like some of the animation stuff is great. Some of it's not so good. This was particularly not a great one. So, we were all kind of just sitting in the screening room and it was like, There were a few nice pieces, and you know, but for the most part, it was disappointing. Big House Blues, the very first episode of Ren and Stimpy, was the final cartoon of this festival. And I'd never seen anything like it. I could not stop laughing. And it said that it was, you know, I looked at the press kit, and it said that it was going to be on Nickelodeon. And that was in December of 1990. And I kept scouring the TV guide back when, you know, you would have a TV guide. Scouring the TV guide, looking for this Ren and Stimpy show on Nickelodeon. Didn't debut till August of 91. So it was almost a year of me
trying to
figure it out. And then finally it debuted, and it's one of the greatest shows of all time. So, okay, we're moving on here, and we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, and we are talking about the most controversial TV characters of all time, and we'll continue to do so. We want to hear from you. We are live in the Skyline Studio, continuing the show here. The Nick DiGilio show continues right here on 720 WGN. Tom Hush is my producer, and we would love to hear from you. We are talking about controversial TV characters that we all know and have talked about, and some of the most controversial TV characters of all time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we've got some texts coming in, and we do want to hear from you. Let's see. 773 says, most controversial character is a toss-up between Stephanie Forrester from Bold and the Beautiful and Joey from Gimme a Break, the kid dressed up in blackface for Pete's sake. I don't remember. Gimme a Break was the one with Nell Carter, right? That was the one with Nell Carter. Yeah. And Dolph Sweet, where she played the... She played like the maid, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember the... I remember the kid, Joey, from Gimme a Break. I don't remember him dressed up in blackface, though. I've never watched Bold and the Beautiful. My mom watches Bold and the Beautiful. She probably knows who Stephanie Forrester is. You ever watch any soap operas? Do you ever get hooked on a soap opera, ever?
No. not... Well, I did used to watch a little bit of British soap operas for a second, like there'd be days when I'd be visiting the UK, and you get kind of like you're just having a little bit of a lazy morning,
yeah.
Where you're gonna go do something later that afternoon, but you're just kind of hanging out,
yeah,
on vacation. And there's two of them that I used to enjoy watching: EastEnders and Coronation Street.
I've seen EastEnders. I love EastEnders.
It's just so.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean they're really taking the mick out of a little bit out of like East End Londoners.
Yeah.
Like very, very working class, very, you know, in the show, they make them very kind of trashy.
Yeah.
And, but Coronation Street's a classic. Everybody loves Coronation Street.
My friend Scott Oaken and I, when we were living together, became obsessed with All My Children. We watched it every day.
You couldn't pay me.
Watched it every day. We loved it.
That's a little bit too much for me.
Yeah, he would watch it right before he would leave for work, because he worked during the day. He was a manager at Venture, which is kind of like, you don't remember Venture, but Venture is like kind of a Kmart.
Mm-hmm.
It was a department store, Venture. And my old roommate, Scott, was a manager there. And All My Children was on at noon. And so we would watch it every day. And then we got obsessed with the Days of Our Lives, was it? Because it was on beforehand. It was on, because All My Children was ABC, and Days of Our Lives was NBC. But it was on before All My Children. And there was a plot where, I can't remember her name, but her character gets possessed by the devil.
Oh, jeez.
And it was hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And so we started watching that because it was on before. We were flipping around and I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Because she had like contact lenses in, she was talking in a deep voice, and there was a a reverend on the show, hunky reverend named John Black. And he was exorcising her. And so for a few weeks we were watching that just because she was possessed. Classic. I can't remember her name. I can't remember the actress's name. Marlene something, maybe? And it was hilarious. You know, it's just a regular stupid daytime daytime.
Yeah, show. Marlena Evans.
Marlena, is that right?
Yes.
Does it say she got possessed?
That's.
Nope.
She was portrayed by Deirdre Hall.
That's right, Deirdre Hall. That's right.
And it's Marlena Evans, and she got some of the most outrageous circumstances in soap opera history, including possession by the devil.
Yep.
Plummet from a 30-story window, which she survived. Being used as a surrogate for genetically engineered babies. During a 4-year coma, where she was presumed dead after being involved in a plane crash, being mind controlled to believe she was a serial killer, becoming, having hysterical amnesia, and has been kidnapped numerous times over the past 30 years.
Yeah. That character's been through a lot, man. But we watched it when she was possessed because we thought it was hilarious. And the guy, I don't know what the actor's name is who played John Black. One of the worst. I mean, he's just, you know, like one of the really over the top soap opera actor, you know, like mugging big time. And he was, you know,
yeah, Donald Hodgestein. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that name.
What's John Black is his name, right?
Yeah, John Black.
Yeah, he was just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. 262 says, Nick, would the X-Files fall into that category? Controversial TV characters, yeah.
Some of it.
Some of them, like the cigarette smoking man. Dan and Marengo says, two shows to mention, The Young Ones and Benny Hill. The Young Ones.
Absurd.
I love that show.
That was great.
I love that show.
Great program.
847 says, Mr. Hankey, who led to a lawsuit between the creators of Ren and Stimpy and the creators of South Park over who had the rights of talking fecal matter. Yeah. Joe Carroll from The Following. You watched The Following?
I watched a little bit of it. Wasn't particularly overjoyed with it, but it was interesting.
Who was in it?
Kevin Bacon and
That one. Yeah.
The one about Edgar Allan Poe and
yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. I did watch that because of Poe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wearing a Poe t-shirt this morning. Most of the TV characters on our list are fictional, but Joe Carroll is no exception. In the TV series which aired on Fox, Joe Carroll is a serial killer who accumulates a number of followers, hence the name of the show. Joe and his followers brutally murder innocent people, and in the first season they kill women just for having the same name as Joe's wife. Most of the time they are always one step ahead of the law, and their cult is quite successful. Joe is considered a controversial TV character for obvious reasons. Whenever you're rooting for a serial killer, it doesn't set a great example for your viewers. I totally forgot about that show.
I think most of America did.
Yeah. I watched it just because of Poe. That's the only reason I watched it. So, all right. We're continuing here with some more controversial TV characters, and we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 as we continue. You know, DJs would play that song if they had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I'll see you in a minute.
Yeah. It's Nick DiGilio here, and we continue, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200, and we are talking about the most controversial TV characters of all time. There's been plenty, and we would love to hear from you. Talk and text, 312-981-7200. It's the Nick DiGilio Show, continuing on. Tom Hush is my producer. My dad is going to call in and tell a joke in just a few minutes, and we have a Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's game. Big game for the Hawks and a big night for Patrick Kane, and we will play that back coming up here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us for talk or text. So next, as far as TV characters, controversial TV characters of all time, Eric Cartman from South Park. I absolutely agree. You know, the stuff that comes out of Cartman's mouth is just so insane sometimes when you watch that show. It would be impossible to create a list like this, they say, and not include Eric Cartman. He is hands down one of, if not the most controversial cartoon character in TV history. Matt Stone and Trey Parker brilliantly created this little overweight, annoying, talking, bluntly overweight character, and that somehow endeared fans. Perhaps it's his crazy voice or simply his devilish ways, but it's obvious that Cartman is a fan favorite, considering how much homophobic, racist, and misogynistic verses come out of his mouth. It's a wonder the show receives its share of criticism on a weekly basis. No wonder. Then again, it also receives its due praise. Yeah, Cartman, you can't, I mean, if you're talking about controversial TV characters of all time, you can't not include Eric Cartman. Sometimes I watch that show and I just can't believe what they've written for that character. Like, it's just unbelievable. And yet everybody loves him. Everybody loves him. And they mention it in the description here, but the voice is so classic. Like Trey Parker providing that the Cartman voice. There's no other character in the world that sounds like that. And it adds to the hilariousness of the character. But yeah. How about Maude Finley? We mentioned Maude a little bit earlier as one of the most controversial TV characters. Abortion has always been a hot topic, and Maude Finley, the TV character on the show named Maude, was under fire for allegedly trying to make abortion look like a good thing to do. It was groundbreaking for television, and Bea Arthur caught a ton of flack for participating in that kind of dialogue. In the series, Maude gets pregnant unexpectedly and chooses a procedure to procure an abortion. Apart from that, she also... she was perceived as a character who tried to break the barriers for women, hence making her controversial figure in those times, who wanted women to stay under the rule of their husbands and stick the old-fashioned way. Yeah, Maude in general was a controversial show. So, but you know, I mean, again, that's Norman Lear. Norman Lear pushed all the hot buttons back in those days. Yep. Let's see. G in D.C. says Michael Scott in The Office. Some of my coworkers still do the... That's what she said. I cringe every time. Thanks, guys. You rock. Yeah, Michael Scott in The Office. 612 sends in a text. Morton Downey Jr., he smoked and said, zip it. I remember when Morton Downey Jr. was... just unbelievably popular. For people who don't remember, Morton Downey Jr. was this provocateur who had a talk show, and very confrontational. He would have guests on and smoke in their face and scream at them. They would debate topics, and it was sort of like it was your basic sort of like exploitive Geraldo type show, but only it went way farther than that. And Morton Downey Jr. Took off in the 80s, became very, very, very popular, and his show was nuts. His show was just nuts. People screaming at each other, swearing, he's smoking, blowing smoke in people's faces, and nothing but, like arguments, and he would have skinheads on and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was very similar to the kind of stuff that, you know, Geraldo and that group of TV hosts did. Except Morton Downey Jr. just took it to another level. I mean, it was truly an outrageous show. Did you ever see Morton Downey Jr.?
No, I never got the chance.
Do you know who he is?
I feel like it sounds familiar.
He was a talk show host in the 80s, a confrontational talk show host in the 80s, whose show was insane. It was insane. And it was wildly popular. But then, you know what he's most known for? He faked an attack in an airport. He said that skinheads attacked him, shaved part of his head, and drew a swastika on his face, when in fact he did it himself for attention.
You know what I remember him from?
Mm.
Predator 2.
He is in Predator 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
that's like my main thing.
He's also in one of the Freddy movies, if I'm not mistaken, isn't he?
Let's see.
I think he's in one of the Nightmare movies.
Yeah, he was really, I recognize him. He was really one of the premier like trash talk, TV guys. He started with the Springer thing.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, that's what his whole show was. His show is just, it was nuts. It was it was that confrontational sort of Springer kind of thing, but only on a different level.
He was not in any of the Nightmare.
Well, I know there was a talk show host on one of the Nightmare movies, and I can't remember which one.
He was in Tales from the Crypt.
Yes.
He was in Revenge of the Nerds 3.
He was in Revenge of the Nerds 3?
I didn't know there was more than one.
That was made for TV. I remember talking to Curtis Armstrong about it.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So anyway, Martin Downey Jr. There was a time when he was hugely popular. I watched it all the time. I thought it was hilarious. But real controversial.
He smoked a ton, right?
Oh, my God. That's what killed him.
Yeah, he died of lung cancer, age 68.
Yep.
Back in 01.
And smoked right on the show. He'd blow smoke in people's faces. Can you imagine trying to do that now on the show?
No, I really can't. That is a very different time.
But I'll tell you something, man. I remember the episode where he took on The Last Temptation of Christ. And he was a Christian and said that he was going to hate this movie. And, you know, had people who were opposed to it and had people who were protesting. Because when Last Temptation of Christ came out, the Scorsese movie, you weren't alive, Tom. But the controversy was, I mean, through the roof. There were people protesting outside theaters, people who hadn't even seen the movie. And Martin Downey Jr. was going to have, you know, people on to talk about the movie. And then he ended up seeing it and he loved it. And he's like a Christian. And he said, it's a beautiful movie. It's really, really good. And so, like, he changed his mind completely. And I've always remembered that. I thought he was going to be screaming about how much he hated it. And then he actually really liked it and ended up defending the movie, on the show. So, all right, another controversial character on TV. Hannah Baker from 13 Reasons Why. The dramatic TV series released early this year also makes its way onto our list as it has a share of controversy, too. It was received with mixed emotions, with some people claiming it's the best TV series of 2017, while the other half claims that Hannah Baker, who is the TV character with the series that the series revolves around, does not create a good picture to other young people in society. Some claim that her role in the show promotes suicide, underage drinking, body shaming, and rape culture among students, while others claim that by airing such sides of society, it creates awareness. Trust me, you don't want to find yourself in the middle of an argument between the critics and the fans of this TV show. Next is Jodi Dallas from Soap. This is what I was telling you earlier, Billy Crystal. In the early 80s, culture was not only experiencing changes in the economic sector, but also in its culture. And as we know, change is never accepted by many people. Thus, the LGBT community was unacceptable to many people back then. That's why Jodi Dallas is one of the most controversial TV characters in that age, as he was the first gay character to be on TV. Jodi was constantly ridiculed and scrutinized by many religious organizations, while many campaigns were held against the TV show Soap. Well, Soap caused a lot of controversy just in general, not just because of having the first openly gay character on TV. But Soap was, All right, another Simpson here. Bart Simpson. Because we know Bart Simpson, when The Simpsons first hit the air back in the late 80s, it was all about Bart. You know what I mean? It was all about don't have a cow, man. And all of the catchphrases and Bart, Bart being a very controversial character. And then as the show grew, it became more about Homer. Like, Homer became kind of the main character. And then, as it grew even more, it became about Springfield itself. You know, like the whole town. The whole show itself has been subject to controversy and scrutiny, The Simpsons. and hence selecting one character to be the most controversial is quite a daunting task. However, after watching several episodes, there is no doubt that Bart is the most controversial TV character in The Simpsons show. He plays the son of Homer Simpson and is always misbehaving, but the parents just let it pass, or even if he tries to punish him, they end up taking him up for ice cream. Most parents argue that including such a character on a TV show that kids watch is not right, because they may end up thinking that they are not supposed to be punished, thus developing hatred towards their parents when they get grounded or any other form of punishment possible. It caused a huge stir when Bart Simpson, you know, when The Simpsons first broke, because there wasn't a character like that on TV, and the fact that it was animated, you know. The Simpsons was never really a kid's show, though. Not aimed at kids. I mean, kids can watch it, but it's definitely an adult show. It always has been. Do you have a favorite Simpsons episode? Have we talked about this?
Yeah, the monorail episode.
Oh, the monorail.
Still makes me laugh every time.
Yeah, I love that episode. My favorite, though, is Homer's Enemy.
Yeah.
Why am I blanking on his name? Frank, the guy who gets the job at the plant.
And he dies.
Yeah, he dies.
He dies in
Grimes. Grimey.
Frank Grimes. Yeah.
Frank Grimes, yeah. That's my favorite episode.
And anything to do with Troy McClure.
Well, since you like the monorail, that's obviously
exactly
the late, great Phil Hartman. I remember watching that episode, Homer's Enemy, with Frank Grimes. My ex-wife and I were watching it. And when it ended and they killed him off and Homer's laughing at the grave and everybody, no, Homer's sleeping. Marge, change the channel. It's boring. That's a Homer. And then everybody starts laughing as they drop his coffin into the ground. I was like, is this real? Is this really? Are they really ending this episode like this? So, all right, let's do some quick weather, and then we'll come back. And my dad's going to tell a joke. We got a Blackhawks, a pretty special Blackhawks Express to play back as well.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah. What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
That's right. Every Monday morning, my dad tells a joke, and we continue. The show continues right here. It's the Nick DiGiulio Show on a Monday morning. Tom Hush is my producer, and we continue, with my dad's joke. My dad's been telling jokes his whole life, so we thought, hey, how do you start off your work week with a joke from my dad? And here he is. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Ned.
How are you?
Good.
Good. How's Ma?
Doing great.
Good. Okay. Got a joke.
So a man asked his wife, what would you do if I won the lottery? The wife said, I'd take half and leave you. Said, great, I won $12. Here's $6. Get out.
All right. All right.
All right, that's a good one, Dad. Thanks, man.
Yeah, you know, the controversial one, like in the 60s, maybe, or what? Tom Duggan. He used to have his own show, and he was very controversial.
Oh, is that right? I don't remember that.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thanks, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
All right,
bye.
See you later. There you go. There's my dad. He'll be a... Yeah.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
And he will do it again next Monday morning. It's amazing how many jokes he tells about bad marriages, and my mom and him have been married for like 8,000 years. Also, tomorrow on the show, our great friend from Mad Magazine and Match Game, Dick DiBartolo, will talk us about some wacky gadgets that you can find anywhere. And also, comedian Fall Farivar returns with his hilarious show, Everyone's a Lawyer at the Laugh Factory. And that's right here on the Nick DiGiulio Show, which continues. And let's see. Do you remember when Morton Downey appeared at WrestleMania to debate Roddy Piper from the 847 area code? Yes, I do. It was hilarious. 218 area code. You got to say Bill Maher doesn't get more controversial than him. That's true. That's true. And then 815 area code says, what about Artie Johnson on Laugh-In? Was Artie Johnson controversial? I don't remember. All right. Well, there you go. That's some more controversial TV characters, and we wrap that all up.